FM to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening and or good morning wherever you may be across this great land of ours, well beyond, around the world, in fact, every single time zone, all 24 of them. I'm Art Bell and this is Coast to Coast AM. Tonight is going to be a kind of a special night in a lot of ways. In a whole lot of ways, actually. We are going to do what we haven't done. Well, let me get my other announcements out of the way first. First of all, welcome to WJZM in Clarksville, Tennessee. 1400 on the dial in Clarksville, Tennessee. And I'd like to say hi to the general manager there, Hank Bonecutter. That's his name, Bonecutter. Anybody remember the movie Bone Daddy? What a name. I wonder if he was a wrestler. That'd be a great wrestler's name, wouldn't it? Hank Bonecutter. In this ring, Hank! Anyway. So, last train to Clarksville, WJZM, 1400 on the dial. Welcome to the network. Glad to have you as we continue to climb above 500 affiliates. And I've got to get a number, as a matter of fact. Well, we're going to do something that we haven't done for years tonight, later tonight. In fact, in about 23 minutes or something. There's so much to tell you about all of this. As you know, one of my colleagues, Rush Limbaugh, who works for the same network as I do, is going deaf. And they are trying all sorts of things, whatever medicines and treatments they can try, along with the possibility of an implant and a lot of other things, but what basically happened to Rush is he went just suddenly over a period of a very few months, he began to lose his hearing. And Rush and I and many others have been in radio all our lives, and we all suffer some hearing loss, you know, as a regular part of the job. You wear headphones and you crank them up. You know, that's the way it is. I love my music and I crank it up. And I have ever since I began in radio. So we all have some hearing loss. But what has happened to Rush is way beyond that. Whatever it is causing this, it is my understanding. You know, we all have a little hairs inside of our ear. And basically these hairs vibrate and they transmit that vibration, which we call sound, into the electronic impulses that become what we hear. And for whatever reason, those are dying. In fact, by now may have mostly died, and with it, Rush is hearing. Now, years ago, on this program, I began a series of experiments. Interesting, almost frightening in their effectiveness. Some interesting experiments in which we dabbled probably in areas where we should not have. We endeavored to have millions of you, as many as are listening at any one given time to this program, to concentrate on one single thing. We changed the weather with several experiments that were absolutely astounding. We changed the weather. Without question, we changed the weather. In areas that had drought or too much rain, we reversed the situation. We made rain happen where there weren't even clouds. Rain wasn't even anywhere near the forecast. Within hours, actually in some cases minutes of doing what we did here on the air, we made rain. We did that. In several geographic locations in the U.S. and Canada, these experiments began to kind of scare me. We intervened in a couple of important health issues. Richard C. Hoagland, my guest in the next hour, is one of them when he had a heart attack. Daniel Brinkley when he had brain surgery. In both cases, both parties, well, Richard will come on tonight and explain to you what he felt when we did that. Now, you know me. I'm a pretty much of a, you know, hands-on kind of person. I got to be able to see it to believe it. We did it. We did it. In what we call the grand experiments, it worked. Now, Princeton University has been doing something for some time that coincides with what we're going to do tonight. And so Rush is not going to be the only experiment. He's going to be the first one that we're going to do together here in a little while. But later on in the program, we're going to do another for Princeton University, where they have these random number generators. And the damnedest thing has been happening, folks. The damnedest thing. For example, if you look at 911, they've been monitoring random number generator computers, big ones, at Princeton, and at several other places in the U.S. Richard will tell you about it, for some time now, without my knowledge, and I'm sure yours, and they were trying to prove a correlation between large events happening in the world, like the 911 tragedy, and other things that, you know, everybody becomes aware of in the news, big things in the news that affect everybody. And they would watch these random number generators and chart them, much as you might chart a Richter scale, a seismometer, for Earth movement. And the doggonest thing began to happen as large national events occurred. They would begin to get spikes, like you would with a seismograph. The spikes would start. And they coincided with what was happening. In other words, mass consciousness, your mass consciousness, mine, all of ours together, are producing changes in random number generators at Princeton. Richard will tell you what happened on 911. It's the most amazing story. I just began to hear about this, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks ago. Richard knows a whole lot more about it. He'll be telling you about it in the next hour. So, experiment number one tonight is going to be for Rush Limbaugh. Experiment number two tonight is going to be specifically for Princeton. We are going to try to send that little needle right off the graph. Since they're actually, and Princeton has been contacted, and they are going to be monitoring that graph tonight. The readout, it's easier to think of as a graph, like a seismograph. And we're going to try to push the needle right off the chart. So we've got some important work to do tonight. More about that in a couple of moments. Listen, I promised an announcement, and it's a little early, but I'm going to make the announcement anyway. As you know, we have a pay stream now to listen to this program and other programs on Premier Networks. What I'm going to tell you is roughly true. The price, I think, is approximately $7 a month to listen. And I have pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed, and it is going to now be reduced to $5 per month, approximately, through the following means. Premier will be offering a new, lower-priced, 6-month streaming audio subscription, and instead of about $83.40 a year, we are going to reduce the price to $29.95 for 6 months. How's that sound? Now, that is substantial. That goes down from about, on a monthly basis, from about 7 to 5. It's when you buy a 6-month subscription. A current monthly subscribers, those who already signed up, thousands of you, wanting to take advantage of the new 6-month special, will be able to upgrade their subscription for a cost of just $23 for 6 months. $23 for 6 months. So there you have it. That was the best I could hammer. I am very concerned with this issue, as many of my listeners are. It has to be. It's one of those things that has to be. And I fully understand people really, really don't like to start paying for something they've had for free before, but that's the way it is. The costs have got to be met. And as we discover we can meet the costs with people signing up, which they are doing rapidly, we can then reduce it to just cover the cost. And that's exactly what's happening. So that takes it down about like $2 a month, which I think is pretty good. So there you have it. That's the news on the audio streaming. I promised you I would give you what news I would have tonight. It's not going to be apparent until either, you know, like Friday or Monday. I'm not sure. You'll see it on the website. You'll see the change. Now, something pretty wild is happening to the Bell family. tomorrow, this time zone, later today in some time zones. Several years ago, as you know, I'm a big fan of Crystal Gayle. Really a big fan of Crystal Gayle's. And we actually got to go and meet Crystal. She's been on the show a couple times, and she may be on the show tomorrow night because we got a call, and tomorrow afternoon, you got to know I'm excited about this. Crystal Gayle is going to come to lunch. She's coming here to the house, to my home. And we had invited her several years ago when we saw her show in Las Vegas. And so we got a call, and she's gonna come and visit. Crystal Gayle is going to come and visit and have lunch, which I think is pretty cool. And in honor of that, I have put on my website, on my webcam tonight, this is a poster I have of Crystal that I've kept for several years. And this was Crystal, I think, at about 18 years of age. A big poster. I think it's a pretty rare poster right now. Fairly rare. And so I held it up for the webcam just about 30 seconds before I went on the air. In fact, when did I do that? Yeah, 22:04:21. Just before I went on the air, I managed to hold up the poster and get the picture up on my webcam. So that's Crystal Gayle at 18. And, boy, what an angel with an angel's voice. So, let's see. Let me do a little quick break, and then I will read you what news there is of the day. And, of course, it's not all that good. Stay right where you are.
Looking for the truth? You'll find it on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, Jesse, people just don't want to believe that government is screwing them up. They just don't want to believe it.
They want to believe the government is looking out for your best interests. Well, I got news for you. Government is made up of people, and people can be corrupted, and evil people can get in power, and for some reason, nobody wants to admit that somehow the United States government could be evil.
Now we take you back to the night of October 18th, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
All right. Let's look briefly at the news, and it's not very good, of course. Seems like a new pair, that's two, of anthrax cases today has now brought the number of confirmed cases nationwide to 6 since October 4th, complicating the Bush administration's efforts to reassure the anxious nation it was working aggressively to combat terrorism, bioterrorism, and other threats. A CBS employee who opened Dan Rather's mail, as well as a postal worker in New Jersey, were added to the troubling roster of Americans infected with anthrax. They're offering $1 million to information leading to the capture of the bastards who did this. Again, it would be interesting to know the source of all this, and they're trying very hard to find out. Kabul residents said today, U.S. jet strikes hit homes, killed at least 5 civilians, their words, remember, including a 16-year-old girl and 4 in a family who lived near a Taliban tank unit. Collateral damage. Donald Rumsfeld said today that victory in Afghanistan is going to require putting troops on the ground, right, in addition to bombing. And so that tells you probably the troop time is getting near. In a courthouse ringed by shotgun-toting marshals a few blocks from the smoking ruins of the World Trade Center, 4 disciples of Osama bin Laden were sentenced to life without parole for the deadly 1998 bombing of two U.S. embassies in Africa. I don't understand why they didn't get the death penalty. Do you? I don't understand. I just don't get that. And in my opinion, why? They should get the death penalty. Should have gotten the death penalty. Not life in prison. They don't deserve to live. They killed. You can look at it any way you want, biblically or any other way. And, of course, you know, I feel the very same way about the situation with regard to those who are sponsoring this and doing it in Afghanistan. They should just die. They should just die. Really seems a little bit of a, I don't know what the right word is, to feel that on the one hand and be prepared to try what I'm going to try on the other. But that's me. I understand both extremes, and I hope you do too. In other words, I do have what I feel vengeance. You know, I watched Dan Rather on Larry King tonight talk about his assistant, and I feel a lot of anger about this. And my anger translates to what I will unabashedly call vengeance. I want vengeance. I want people over there who did this dead. Other people would say a kinder word is justice. Either way, dead. As Rush would say, room temperature. So how can somebody with those feelings, on the one hand, do what I'm about to do now? I don't know. It's just part of my makeup. On the one hand, I feel that, and that's my opinion with regard to what's going on with this war. But on the other hand, I understand this great, unknown, and perhaps unknowable power that we're about to exercise. And yet, I understand it works. I don't understand how. Now, some people are going to say, look, don't kid yourself. It's God. It's prayer. And I don't reject that. That's fine. Prayer works. But it also seems to work to go into a state of intense concentration. And what I'm going to ask you to do as we go to the bottom of the hour, which we're close, a few minutes here, is as it begins, I want all of you to imagine in your mind, and this is what you have to do, just close your eyes, block out everything else, and I really mean block out everything else. We'll have several minutes here at the bottom of the hour, probably 5 or 6 minutes. And during that time, please concentrate as follows. You can do any variation of this that you wish, and I think it will be effective if we all do it together. Imagine the new, I might add, more svelte, thinner, Rush Limbaugh, and imagine his ears, and imagine these hairs that are supposed to be there to vibrate, to produce sound, and imagine them healing. And imagine his hearing returning. And what you can do is project white light, if you want, with that in mind. I'm setting it up for you right now. If you're listening to me, then you're getting set up right now as to how to do this. It's just a matter of quietly closing your eyes and intensely concentrating and projecting white light, which is a healing light. Say a prayer if you wish, if you are so inclined, a real prayer. But most of all, intensely concentrate. When this break begins here in a couple minutes, just cast everything out. Forget the break. Forget everything until I get back after the commercial set. And during the whole time, concentrate on Rush's ears healing, on his hearing returning. Close your eyes and just do only that. Princeton University is going to be monitoring what we do here in a minute, as well as next hour, because we're going to do another experiment next hour. This one's all for Rush. And I know that a lot of people don't like Rush because of what he believes and says, and that's fine. But I would think the majority of you, in fact, I know the majority of you who will participate in the coming experiment, whether you agree or disagree with him, surely would love to help a fellow human being regain his hearing, and that's what we're going to try to do. So, beginning right now, close your eyes and begin concentrating on healing for Rush Limbaugh. I'm Art Bell.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001.
And I'm ready for the times to get better. I've been racking my brain, hoping to find a way out. I've had enough of this continual rain. Changes are coming, no doubt. It's been a too long time with no peace of mind, and I'm ready for the times. Don't know when I've been so blue. Don't know what's come over you. You found someone. And don't it make my brown eyes blue? I'll be fine when you're gone. I'll just cry all night long. Say it is all.
Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001.
Oh, that's Crystal Gayle. All right, that's the end of experiment, or part one of experiment number one. Part two will come in about 25 minutes. And that's Crystal Gayle. She's coming to lunch tomorrow, coming out to Pahrump, Nevada. She said she wanted to come out to the desert, and I said, hey, that's where I live, in the desert. You want to see the desert? Come on out. So she's gonna. I am so excited about that. She's been one of my favorites all my life. Crystal Gayle. Voice of an angel. Face, too. I've got a poster up of Crystal Gayle when she was about 18 years of age that I got up about a minute before broadcast. I just held it up. I've kept that for a long time. Anyway, so that was the end of part one. We'll do part two at the top of the hour. Richard C. Hoagland will be here, and he will explain what's going on at Princeton and what they found that verifies what we've been doing. Do not pin me down and try to make me say how I know this works. I simply have more than reasonably proven to myself, and I don't come to believe this kind of thing easily. I'm not an easy sell on this kind of thing. I'm very much a skeptic. I really am. I know people will chuckle. Because I allow people to say on the air whatever they want to say, tell their story, you know. That's my way of doing interviews. It doesn't mean that I believe it all, nor should you. I'm pretty much a skeptic, and I've got to be able to lay my hands on something before I really believe it. Well, I believe doing these experiments works. You can say it's God. You can say it's the power of the human mind. You can attribute anything you want to it. I don't care. I just know it works. I don't know how. I just know it absolutely works. It's happened again and again and again, too many times. I know, to the point where it scared me and I stopped doing it. It takes a lot to get me going. Tonight, for two reasons, I'm going pretty hard on it. One, because of Rush and his hearing loss. But the second, because, it, coincidentally, Princeton all of a sudden is doing these experiments that would seem to absolutely verify what I know to be true anyway. So I'm not surprised, but I think a lot of you will be interested to hear what it is they're doing there and what they've noticed. It'll blow your mind. Absolutely will blow your mind. Stay right where you are. We'll be right back.
Now we take you back to the night of October 18th, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Here we go into the night from the high desert on the wild card line. You are on the air. Good morning.
Hi, Art.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm out here in Elkmont, Alabama.
Alabama. Okay, what's your first name?
My name is Sean.
Sean. Okay, Sean.
Yes, before the break, before the mass concentration for Rush.
Yes.
You were saying that you're not sure why it works.
No, I'm not.
People, and some people call it prayer.
Yes.
I just thought I might bring it to your attention that in the Bible, in Genesis chapter 11, 6, God recognizes this ability of mass concentration.
He does.
Yes. It says, the Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them.
Huh. That's wild.
And that was referring to the Tower of Babel.
That is wild.
Yes, sir.
Well, I again, you know, maybe it's God. I would never say otherwise. Maybe it's the will of man in conjunction with God.
Yes,
I don't know. There's so many ways that you can think about it. But the mass concentration of the will of man seems to do things. I've seen the weather change, sir. I've seen things that would curl your hair. We've done it on this program. I haven't done it for years because I started to get scared of what I was doing.
Well, yeah, God was saying specifically that it's a power inherent in man, that if we all collectively put our will to anything, we will accomplish it.
Well, I don't doubt
it. That was why he struck down the Tower of Babel and confounded the tongues, breaking up the common language into separate languages so that man wouldn't be able to do that anymore.
Well, I frequently have a confounded tongue. thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome.
And take care. Yes, what an unusual opportunity. And I don't do this lightly. I understand we're at 513 radio stations or 14 or something. And that's an enormous number of people. And so we do have this rare opportunity to get this many people doing this at once. As far as I know, it's not been done elsewhere. I've never seen this done anywhere else in the American media. I don't think it's ever been done before. And it did, honest to God, it scared me. I began to think, you know, this is great, but we really don't know what we're doing. And particularly with the weather experiments, it scared me because it began to work in a couple of cases too well. We began to get floods in areas that had been drought-stricken previously shortly after we did it, and that sort of caused me to withdraw a little bit in terms of continuing the experiments because I didn't and don't understand the power. And you could make a mistake. My thinking back then was, you know, people were emailing me saying, come on, Art, there's a bad hurricane out there. Let's turn it away from the coast. And I started thinking, you know, I don't know what the heck I'm doing. And it could be that if this power is, at that point I was beginning to believe it was certainly real, that we might stall a hurricane off the coast, and the damn thing would build up to ridiculous proportions and then come ashore. And I thought, I better stop tampering around with that sort of thing. In this arena, the arena of healing, as in the case of Rush, I think that we can't cause him to have too much hearing, if you follow me. So I think we're safe in trying to do something good like this. It is a wild power, which I don't think you can abuse, and I don't think you can second guess, but I know it's true. And as I say, I don't believe these things easily at all. I proved it to myself so much that I had to stop for those reasons. So it's been a few years since we've done this. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Rush. Oh, excuse me. I got to hear you talking about Rush so much. Sorry about that. All right.
Yes, sir.
I'd just like to say first that you do a great job.
Thank
and,
you.
And while I was going to school in Mobile, I picked up on your show down there. But I'm in Birmingham, Alabama at the time now.
Okay.
And I'd just like to comment on maybe how this little anthrax scare maybe could be a diversion by maybe the terrorists that are doing it.
Well, so far as I can see, it's very effective so far. In other words, we've got 6 people who have contracted it. 1 person has died.
Yes.
Various forms of control. Well, no, wait, let me finish.
Okay.
6 people, right? And when you consider that the country is terrorized, right? I mean, look at the media, the amount of media coverage of this. They're terrorized.
Mm-hmm.
That's the intent of the terrorists, whoever they are, to have that done. Now, there are 20,000 people that die every year from the flu. So you've got to keep what's happening, at least right now, in context. It's awful, but it's only 6 people. 20,000 die from the flu every year. So instead of running out and trying to stock up on doxycycline or whatever it is you're trying to get, people ought to be scrambling for flu shots.
Yes. I'd really like to get your comment on one thing. I respect your opinion on subject matter that you speak of.
Sure.
And do you not feel that America could be slipping into maybe a police state or something of some type of where we're just giving our civil liberties and maybe forgetting about what our forefathers and people really fought for to get away from Europe in this you know, one world type.
Yeah, that's the danger, of course.
I mean,
it's a danger, but it's not like there's any choice right now.
I'd like to just say Thomas Jefferson did say that people who sacrifice their
freedom
for liberty, I mean for security,
safety.
Uh-huh. Will end up with neither security nor their liberty, freedom.
Yep.
And before you let me go, I'd just like to suggest a guest on your show. It seems that I know you've had Father Malachi, and I love that. I would consider myself a Christian, but I still am open-minded enough that I will listen to anybody's viewpoint, right?
Sure.
And I have been listening. I've read some books on Hal Lindsey. Have you ever heard of that gentleman?
Of course.
He has been in touch with his show about international news, not just from a Christian perspective, but just news in general that we don't get from our media, and has been, you know, a lot of these people have been telling, you know, America what's really going on and about how the EU and other, you know, the world is sort of trying to wrap us up with them and pull us into their...
Well,
the
I know. I know. The trend underway right now is unmistakable. It is toward an eventual one-world type of control, and that's just the way it's going. Now, how long it's going to take to get there, I don't know. I hope not in my lifetime. I've always hoped that. But it is inevitable. As early human society began by one tribe trading with another tribe, and then we had towns, and towns traded with towns, and then we had cities, and cities traded with other cities, and there was commerce. And then soon, lo and behold, there were other nation states, and pretty soon there was commerce between those nation states. Then we had regions. We had Europe. You know, the common joining in Europe economically. And then we had NAFTA, love it or hate it, we've got it. As this hemisphere attempts to bind together in a trading bloc, and certainly Asia has bonded together as a trading bloc, and now the blocs trade back and forth. And as the world gets smaller, because of telecommunications, because of instant communication, because of a million different things, eventually the borders will crumble and there will be, in essence, one world of some sort. Now, I'm not looking forward to it because it's going to mean a lot of things we may not like. I hope personally it's all modeled after the United States of America, with the rights and constitutional privileges that the world could eventually enjoy. That's the way I hope it turns out. But I understand what this man is worried about. I simply say it's inevitable. You know, this process that is underway that I just described is an inevitable and natural process. And someday, after we're gone, planets will trade with each other. And there will form regions and, if you will, federations. And so it will continue. If we don't blow ourselves off the face of the earth. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, this is Max. I'm calling from Globe, Arizona, but I'm listening from KKOB in
Albuquerque.
Albuquerque.
Yes, sir.
My Sea Crane.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry to say, Art, but your show was just dropped here in Globe.
What happened was that, of course, they're in the market. They're in the Phoenix market, sir, as you know.
Yeah.
And it was just unsupportable to have it on in Globe and have it on in Phoenix.
Well,
because they had to, they had to divide up the Arbitron numbers. When surveys come in, all the credit went to our Phoenix affiliate, KFYI, is what happened. And so nothing you can do about that. You get them too close together, and that can happen.
I have my Sea Crane. I don't care.
I'm sure you're hearing it good and clear. Anyway, what's up?
I have never, ever done an experiment like we just did, and I have trouble hearing myself. I also have a very bad back, 3 crushed discs and 2 herniated, so I know what you're talking about. I'm disabled also. But I did this little deal here, and my ears were on fire, and I crawled inside of Rush's head, and I found something in there that looked like a snail. And it was dripping and oozing something, and I took my little light gun that you gave me and burned it up as best as I could. The hairs are from now. I saw that in my head. I have never ever felt anything like that, and to this day I have never ever done anything like that. I swear it. I hate a liar. I would never lie about something like that.
I understand.
It was absolutely incredible. I hope he gets better.
I hope you're wrong about the snail.
Well, no, it was a little curly thing. It was on the side of his head, and it was inside his ear.
Yeah, well,
it
maybe it crawled in there while he was asleep.
It was one.
I don't want to hear this.
There was one in each ear.
Stop.
Anyway, it's dead now.
Yeah.
He killed it.
Well, good.
Listen, I want to go so you can get somebody else on. I appreciate it.
All right, sir.
I'm going to be sending you an email.
All right.
Please look for it.
It's ArtBell at Mindspring.com. Reminding my audience, snails. Reminding my audience that you've got to email me. You can't send snail mail. We're not opening it. I'd be crazy with the national audience we have. We're a natural target, of course, especially saying what I've been saying. So we stopped opening mail, and please do not send me mail. In all likelihood, the post office is going to begin to refuse mail for us for a period of time. For obvious reasons, I would no more have my wife opening the mail that's coming in than the man in the moon. I just wouldn't do that. It's not worth the risk. She is far too precious to me for that. So we're not accepting snail mail. I think that's true of other talk programs. I'm sure it is. And with what's going on in the media, the terrorists are doing what they obviously can do to achieve maximum bang for the buck. You know, they're sending it to media figures, so the news will get out, and it's working. You know, all the networks are doing big things on it nonstop on CNN and on and on and on. And they're hitting those people for a reason to achieve maximum terror. Again, I ask you all to keep it in perspective. It's terrible that anybody has died from this and that 6 are infected. Terrible. And many more exposed. But keep it in perspective. So many more die of the flu. 20,000 die of the flu. So that's just a perspective for you, so that you aren't too terrorized, because if you're watching the media a lot, you're pretty terrorized over this. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, Mr. Bell.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is Mark in Fort Lauderdale.
Yes, Mark. Hi.
I heard something pretty disturbing on the news, if I have my Art Bell facts straight, which I've been a listener for about a year now, so I hope I do. I was watching MSNBC or Fox News, I don't remember which, I bounced between the two, and they interviewed an anthrax survivor from the 70s, one of the last known cases.
Yes.
And she was discussing, you know, what the symptoms were and how the doctors first treated her.
Right.
And what they called it was hoof-in-mouth disease.
Hmm.
Now, I've never heard anthrax referred to as hoof and mouth.
Well, of course, anthrax is first and foremost a disease that animals have, not humans, usually.
Correct. But, I mean, with all the past, you know, what, 6-7 months ago when they're having a lot of outbreaks of hoof and mouth over in Europe, they never once connected the two together that I remember hearing. This is the first time I ever heard that anthrax is hoof and mouth.
Yeah, I never heard the two used together either.
Well, that's what her doctors had told her that they called it. They called it hoof and mouth, which they said was a slang term for anthrax.
All right, well, maybe.
I also never thought that humans could get hoof and mouth.
Right. Well, of course, in Europe, they essentially do, right? I think there was an outbreak in Europe along with mad cow, wasn't there? All right. Listen, we're going to do it again. This is we're coming up now to part two of this great experiment. And as we go into the break, and during the news break, again, I am going to ask you to simply close your eyes, block out everything else, and concentrate with us. Concentrate on one thing, the healing of Rush's ears. Picture Rush in your mind. As I said earlier, the new svelte, thinner Rush looks pretty good, doesn't he? But what a job he's done in losing weight. Anyway, picture Rush, if you can. Picture his ears, if you can, inside as well as out. And send, pray to God if you want, send white healing light or any healing color that you wish. And do nothing else. Just close your eyes and concentrate as hard as you can on that. During the news, during the break. And when we get back, we'll have Richard C. Hoagland here, because he's going to tell you all about what's going on at Princeton as they're monitoring tonight's experiment and one yet to go. All right, folks, let's begin now. Close your eyes and go into intense concentration, as much healing light as you can send. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Don't touch that dial.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001.
Thank you.
Radio Networks presents Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired October 18, 2001.
Miracles? I don't know. You might want to call them miracles. Or you might have another name for what we're doing. I'm not exactly sure what it is. I just know it works. That was part two of experiment number one. And that concludes experiment number one. And, of course, during the replay later tonight of that first hour, you're welcome to participate at that time as well. Now, experiment number two is going to relate directly to the work going on at Princeton that I just began to find out about 2 or 3 weeks ago, an experiment there that is just absolutely mind-blowing. They are monitoring us tonight. We will have a second experiment in about 25, 23 minutes, whatever, 22 and a half minutes to be precise, in which we're going to try and drive the needle right off the chart at Princeton. Here to tell us all about what's going on there in a few minutes will be Richard C. Hoagland. Don't touch the dial.
Now we take you back to the night of October 18th, 2001. On Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Well, all right, you know him very well. Or if you don't, you will shortly, but I think most of you do. He's a one-time advisor to NASA during the golden years. Oh, we've got to ask about Golden, too. Speaking of Golden, he resigned, you know, Dan Golden. So he was at NASA, and he was an advisor to Walter C. Cronkite during the golden years, or I guess in a way pre-golden years, golden years. And he's the winner of the Engstrom Science Award. He is Richard C. Hoagland, my old friend Richard. Hello, Richard.
Good evening, Art.
From New Mexico, the mountains of New Mexico.
The crystal clear, gorgeous mountains of New Mexico.
Do you realize
that tonight is the first vintage Art Bell show that we're going to do since the horrible events of September 11th?
Well, I think that's right.
And we are going to lift, you know, this audience that is listening to us now is extraordinarily important and special. And I have said over and over again in a lot of different venues that we're basically one vast electronic family, all linked. Well, what we're going to talk about tonight is that is probably not a metaphor. That probably has some basis in real, scientific, verifiable reality. And when I sent you the stuff on this Princeton gang that we're going to talk about, I was so jazzed, and I know you picked up on it immediately because...
Sure.
It's the first objective data that contributes substantively toward proving. It doesn't say it proves yet, but it contributes toward proving a whole bunch of things that you have dealt with on this show for decades. And that's why it is so cool that it's the first real vintage Bell show after this incredible, horrible thing we've all been through. And in the midst of that tragedy... That's how I found this, because the Princeton folks we're going to talk about...
Okay, let's do that. What is happening? When did all of this begin at Princeton? As you know, I only heard about it, what, a couple of weeks ago?
A couple, 3 weeks ago, and I brought it to your attention.
Right.
Well, I'd like to claim credit for having found it myself, but actually it was part of the far-flung Enterprise Network, a guy named David Haish, who actually brought it to my attention.
So what are they doing at Princeton, and for how long have they been doing it?
Well, let me kind of go through the dramatis personae. At Princeton, there is a group called the Global Consciousness Project. Princeton University is one of the Ivy League schools. It houses the Institute for Advanced Studies, where Einstein studied and, you know, taught, and certain mathematicians, I forget, a very famous mathematician was there, Freeman Dyson, who was an old acquaintance of mine, who... is a brilliant astrophysicist. I think Hawking has come to lecture.
Yes.
Anybody who's anybody has wandered through Princeton. But they have this very broad academic venue which allows disparate people to do things that are not exactly in the mainstream. And so a guy named Roger Nelson...
These would be tenured individuals, right?
Yes. Well, that's the whole idea of the academic system is for intellectual freedom. You basically have job security so you can go where no one has gone before.
Yeah, to do this kind of thing, folks, you've got to be tenured. If not, they will strangle you academically and toss you to the wind.
In some places. You know, it depends on where you are. Anyway, a bunch of these guys got together, a guy named Roger Nelson and a guy named Dean Radin, who is over at Ed Mitchell's stomping grounds in California.
I'm going to interview Dean Radin soon.
Ah, well, Dean, you actually, or Coast has had on when
yes.
he's not been there, one of his deputies, a very bright gal who is part of their ESP project, or has founded their ESP project, or is director of it, or whatever. Anyway, these people all kind of had like minds, and beginning about 1996, in December of 96, as I pieced together the history, they had a few informal meetings where they kind of wanted to know, based on the paradigm of a guy named Teilhard de Chardin. Have you ever heard of him?
I've heard the name, yes.
He's a very famous Catholic priest who was a kind of a holistic generalist of the last century. And at the top of Nelson's description of what they did, called Gathering of Global Mind,
mm-hmm.
he has this really amazing quote that I think will set the tenure for the evening. He says, someday, after mastering winds, waves, tides, and gravity, we shall harness the energies of love. And then, for the second time in the history of the world, man will have discovered fire. So this was their raison d'etre. This was their idea. Could they somehow measure the idea of a growing global mind? And because the technology has been improving, you know, decade after decade after decade, there's all kinds of ways to, you know, you have the internet, you have computers, you have, you know, sensory, you know, microprocessors. You have
but
all kinds
how
of...
would you go about
exactly.
measuring the global mind?
That was the big, big MacGuffin, as Hitchcock used to say. What they finally decided to do, and apparently was based out of a project at Princeton that Nelson was running called PAIR, P-E-A-R, which is an acronym. That stands for something which I don't remember at the moment.
Oh, I have the PAIR software here, as you know, where you affect a random number generator on your PC.
That's how it started, because
this
guy is behind that software.
It works. It works, Richard. It'll scare you to death. I don't know if you've got a copy of the program. If you don't, I'll get it to you.
I'd love to have a copy and play with it.
I'll get you a copy.
I think I'm about as talented in this area myself as a dodo.
Oh, no, I'm sure you're very good, Richard. I did it, and it freaked me out. I did controlled experiments. You know, you'd get two pictures, one of random noise, the other of whatever you wanted, the Brooklyn Bridge or, you know, whatever. And your job was simply to make one appear and make the other disappear. Either go totally, make it go totally for the random noise from the random number generator, or make it totally, make the bridge, say, appear, or a picture of the Earth appear with no white noise. And that was your job, mentally, to affect that random number generator. And I found that sitting in front of the monitor, doing it personally, I could score 80, 90, 95, 97 consistently, again and again and again and again without fail. And that if I just walked out of the room and let the program do its random number thing, didn't think about it, didn't even come to mind, I just come back in the room and I look at the score and it's like 25. 26, 27, 30 at the best. Never anywhere near what I could do when I sat in front of the computer. I've done this so many times, Richard. It works. So this, what you're talking about now, grew from that kind of experiment,
that's
right?
That's right.
Okay.
And what they wanted to do was to somehow globalize it so they could measure the developing awareness that we're living in Arthur Clarke's wired world, you know, that the world is becoming alive, that there's... You know, with CNN and the internet and everything that we see and hear now, it's, you know, a sparrow can't fall without somebody knowing about it. So what they were trying to do was to figure out a way to objectively, quantitatively, scientifically measure this idea of a global linkage of minds.
Okay, how do you go about that?
Well, they basically did an offshoot from the software you just described. They decided that they had these little gadgets, which are called random number generators, which are really, they're not computers that spit out random numbers the way most people think of a random number generator who are in the field.
Right.
What they are is a mechanical device, a piece of technology linked to a computer. The computer does the monitoring. It basically takes the place of you in front of your screen. And the device is a transistor or a resistor which generates pure white noise.
Mm-hmm.
Just random garbage. Like if you turn on your TV and you don't have it on a channel at 3 o'clock in the morning,
yes,
and you're out in the middle of the country, you'll see all that speckle.
Yes.
That is random white noise. And what they were able to do was to hook up with a laptop these little gadgets that they made up that were extremely portable, and they called them eggs, E-G-G-S, because it was a kind of a pun on the idea that they wanted to wire the world, and they wanted to do something like an electroencephalogram, but they actually were playing with the phrase electrogaiagram.
Oh, that's
the idea that Gaia, the consciousness
Gaia,
of the Earth.
Gaiagram, that's good.
Electrogaiagram. And then, of course, that was EEG.
Yes.
They went to EGG, and then much later, the formal public name of the project, the Global Consciousness Project, came into being.
Well, I came up with my own analogy. I'm sure you heard me say it. I thought seismograph, and if you think of, you know, they always show on TV when there's an earthquake, they show it going along at a, you know, sort of just very mildly, and then all of a sudden, boom, 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 there's the earthquake.
That's right.
And
well, whatever metaphor or whatever mental image in your mind of an instrument that can sense a change, basically all this gadgetry does is sense a change. And what the changes are is as follows. Under normal conditions, these little gadgets hooked to their computers will spit out random noise, and you will get random spikes up and down, up and down, up and down, just like your seismogram, all right?
Okay.
If, in their model, if consciousness was linked, if there was something that would empathically unite a lot of people for big global events.
In one single kind of thought pattern.
Exactly.
About
in other words, you're watching CNN.
About some specific event.
You see something happen all over the world simultaneously. Their idea, quantified and made scientific with proper protocols and predictions and all that, was that there may be a measurable effect on these random number devices that would make them change from purely random to less random.
How long have they been running this experiment?
They started with Diana's death and the funeral in 1997, September of 97.
You're kidding. So they got a, so what happened?
Well, they have page after page after page on their website, which is linked to a very long article that we have put on our website, and we've got a bunch of links up on Art Bell tonight, so just, you know, click on the ones that are you find interesting. They found a measurable effect. They had apparently 30 of these gadgets distributed around the world, as I understand it.
Oh.
And they were able to, via the internet, link them together, take the data back to a central computer, process it, you know, reduce the results.
Right.
And they came up with about 1 in 100 chance for that experiment that the effect they were seeing was pure chance, purely random.
In other words,
or
associated with the Diana thing.
That's right, which was in the fall of 1997.
All right, also since then, and there have been a lot of major events, not the least of which was September 11th, when there must have been a spike through the roof, if what you're saying is true. Now, when September 11th happened, everybody in the world suddenly got glued in front of their television sets
and
went literally into mental shock over what had happened to this nation and what had happened in New York. I mean, it had to have been one of the more significant events in human history, in a way, in terms of so many minds concentrating on one thing at one time.
Well, this is, again, in their model. They have looked now at all kinds of events from you know, Indian train derailments to Clinton's impeachment to the bombings in Nigeria and Tanzania.
And they've been able to correlate right along the line?
Well, they've been able to correlate some and not correlate others. And the most interesting thing to me, which made me think that there were factors beyond linked consciousness at work here, and we'll get into the details as the morning progresses, was that they found some events that were pretty stark and striking on the world stage had no effect at all. And other events had wonderful effects, statistically way beyond chance, up in the thousands to one.
Richard, what happened September 11th?
Well, it went through the roof.
It did.
That's the positive affirmation of their model.
When did it go through?
That's the negative affirmation, because it started 4 to 5 hours before the impact of Flight 11 into the first World Trade Tower.
4 to 5 hours it began, and it was a through-the-roof kind of charting.
It went through the roof at the moment of the first impact. And then there were spikes during the whole next several hours, up, down, but the overall probabilities were around, I think, 10,000 to 1 against this being a random correlation.
Wow.
And where we got into communication, you know, because they have emailed me and I've emailed them, and we're actually now in an ongoing dialogue.
Okay, they're aware of what we're doing tonight,
right?
They
were aware tonight you were going to do the Rush experiment.
Yes.
I asked them specifically to look at the RNGs. There are 39 RNGs, little random number generators, all over the world, every continent, all right? All linked by the Internet, sending data back at 200 bits per second to the computer at Princeton. And I asked them to specifically, Dean Radin, to specifically look and see if there were any twitches in those random number generators when you did what you did with Rush.
All right. Now I'm moving on to another experiment. Very quickly, Richard, I'm about to ask everybody to concentrate. How would you suggest we concentrate to specifically try and affect the random number generators?
Well, people need to focus. So I would focus on Princeton, New Jersey, which is the center of this experiment.
Right.
It's a bucolic college campus. You know, you've seen a million college campuses if you've never seen Princeton on television. So just imagine a bucolic college campus late in the evening on a Thursday night, you know, in western New Jersey, because that's where Princeton is.
That's Friday morning there.
Well, Friday morning. Okay.
Okay. But concentrate on what? On something becoming non-random? In other words, I want to hit it as hard as I can here.
Well, actually, it almost doesn't matter. It's the coherence of everybody thinking about the same thing. So if you think about the campus, or if you think about the experiment of Princeton, or this is what I would picture. I would picture a huge vortex, like a spinning tornado over Princeton. Think of, remember the white tornado that
Richard, I don't want to do that. We're liable to, sure as hell, that, you know, the last million years, there's never been a tornado at Princeton. I don't want to do that. There's got to be a better way. So
it was a metaphor. It was not literal.
A metaphorical tornado, yeah, but you never know.
Because the physics works by means of vortices, between dimensions.
I understand. All right, hold on, Richard. We're toward the bottom of the hour. Let me modify this a little bit, all right? We know that they're looking at the results at Princeton. So as Richard suggested, picture Princeton and the campus, if you wish, the Ivy League campus, and picture these computers spitting out random numbers, which on a computer screen would produce, for example, white noise, or just like your TV when there's no signal at all. Well, what we want to do is picture non-randomness. Pick a single number if you want. The number 5. I don't care. Pick 5. Pick the number 5. Fine, let's concentrate on 5. In other words, stopping the random nature of what the computers are doing right now. So going into this break, beginning right now, picture Princeton, picture the university, if you wish, in your mind, and take a single number, 5, and concentrate on that, or concentrate on the computers that are randomly spitting out those numbers, stopping what they're doing, and stopping the randomness, and becoming something singular. All of you, together, close your eyes and concentrate on stopping the random nature of what's going on at Princeton. Let's see if we can bring those Pentium to their knees from the high desert. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Begin now.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001.
Far, we've been traveling far. We found our home, but not without a star.
listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 18, 2001.
Good morning, everybody. I've got it. All right, fine. Here's the way we're going to do it. During the next 2 minutes, during the commercial break, I'm going to ask you to try the following. It came to me as I tried my own concentration during the break. Here's the deal. If random numbers are visually presented by white noise on the screen, and they are. In other words, as Richard pointed out, if you were to turn on your TV with no cable connected or antenna, you'd see the millions of white dots. That's white noise. That's random noise. And if that is what's represented by random noise, then when you begin your concentration, I'm going to ask you to do it again during this commercial break. Instead of concentrating or seeing white noise, I want you to see the opposite. What would that be? How about black? How about red or any solid color? Any completely solid color. Instead of seeing the white noise, push with your mind and try and create a solid screen. A solid red, solid blue, solid black, it doesn't matter. The opposite of white noise would be a solid color. Any solid color. It would turn randomness from randomness to non-randomness, right? To put that solid color up there, you'd have to have a great deal of non-randomness. So push with your mind. Imagine starting out seeing that white noise, the flickering on the screen. Then imagine slowly driving that away and producing on the screen only one single solid color, black or any other color you wish to imagine, but driving that random white away. Kind of picture Princeton in your mind, and then picture driving that random noise away and making it into a solid color. Do that during the next 2 minutes break, and then once again at the top of the hour, and that will conclude our experiment. I hope we knock the needles right off the chart at Princeton. Begin now.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001.
All right, this concludes part one of experiment two. Part one of experiment two. I think I'm on to it. I think that's the way to do it. If you picture the white noise as complete randomness, which it is, it represents randomness. And then you picture in your mind, as we will do again at the top of the hour, driving that completely away over Princeton, New Jersey, over the campus of Princeton, driving it away to a solid color of your choice. Even black will do just fine. You are mentally projecting the exact opposite of randomness. What do you think, Richard?
Perfect. Absolutely. I was doing, you know, kind of wondering if we had the right model, and I came very close to what you suggested. It's perfect. It's really perfect. Because the way this works is that normal randomness is what we call entropic. It is random. It is heat. It is thermal. It is noise. And what they have found in these experiments, going back now, I said, to 97, is that these little gadgets, when everyone is linked, their model is that it is more coherent. There's less entropy, there's more structure, there's more coherence to the signal. That's what the computers are reading. So seeing a screen go to one solid color,
right,
is a perfect model to drive these little guys crazy.
Yeah, in other words, if you picture the randomness as represented by all the dots like the TV noise, and then you picture driving that away and converting it to a solid color, you are fighting randomness. And
yeah.
So that should work. Richard, what do you think we're doing?
Well, when you started with your experiments,
yes,
and when you described this little program that you used to play with,
yes,
It seemed to me that it had to be linked to the hyperdimensional physics that we've worked on and researched and talked about for so many, so many years. What is so gratifying is out of the blue to have Dean Radin send me an email saying, you know, I followed your work for several years, and do you have an HD explanation for this effect we found? So obviously other people are looking at their data, because the thing that separates this from purely linked minds are two pieces of information. One happened on September 11th, where all those 39 random number generators all over the world, in Asia, in New Zealand, are scattered around North America, in the Middle East, in South America, all linked by the Internet, began hours before the horrible tragedies we saw on television to begin to rise, to begin to increasingly become less random and more coherent. The screen went from random noise
right.
to more of a solid color, and it was an anticipation of the event.
Well, I've talked to a million people who said that they felt it coming, and I know people scoff.
Yeah,
scoff at that. I know, but I don't. And
none of the psychics I know, the people that I
know, nobody predict. I know nobody predicted it, but I know a million people who felt a big general anxiety.
Well, you yourself were saying weeks in advance.
You better believe it.
Coming.
Something big's
right?
about to happen. I kept saying it. I know, and people can—they're welcome to scoff at that. But I did feel that, and I know a lot of other people.
So one of the models is that we're looking at precognition here. We're looking at some effect that is beyond time. So it was almost like the little RNGs, the little random number generators, were measuring the precognitive future seeing echo
exactly.
of the event before it happened.
Exactly.
That is one possible model. I will grant that. The one that I'm looking at, and obviously I'm attached to this a bit because we've been doing this work for so many years, is that instead of the RNGs measuring linkage of minds, what they're measuring is a background physical process, an effect, a change in the fundamental constants of reality, of the local universe around the Earth, into which these events are fitted so that minds can communicate more easily in those windows, the blockage, the gates or the barriers to linkage between separate minds is
okay.
less in those windows than another time.
Well, remote viewers talk about a non-locality. When you ask them how they do it and what medium they use, and remote viewing I do believe to be real, I've had enough examples, thank you, and as we know the government had it for years and years and years, CIA was doing it, and it's real, and they talk about this non-locality they use, this medium they use that they call a non-locality, right?
Well, there is a theorem called Bell's inequality theorem, which basically says that that can't happen in quantum physics, and it is routinely now in laboratory measurements all over the world violated, where two particles, two subatomic particles, two photons, two spinning electrons, you know, clumps of atoms now have they managed to accomplish this with, through a process called quantum entanglement, meaning they are somehow connected.
I've seen the stories on quantum entanglement lately.
When you divide these fundamental particles...
But, Richard, I had a very well-qualified physicist from, guess where, Princeton on last night, and he politely scoffed at any suggestion of PSI ability or anything else. Sort of a polite, give me a break, huh?
Well, then he goes down the hall and talk to Roger Nelson
He's
and the other guy.
I know.
Come on, you know, this is data.
I know.
It is impossible, unless we're dealing with massive con artists and thieves, intellectual thieves at Princeton, to imagine that somebody could rig these 39 gadgets around the world.
It's not rigged.
No, of course it isn't.
No.
So you've got, you know, as Sherlock Holmes used to say, when you have, you know, eliminated the possible, you have to go for the impossible.
That's right.
And the impossible under the current paradigm is there is some kind of communication which is changing the laws of physics for these little gadgets all over the world
uh-huh.
in synchronization so that they're spitting out their random numbers are less random at some times than other times.
Do you think it has anything to do with God, Richard?
Well, if you think of God as the overall modality of existence, I mean, we're all here by the grace of that. If you think of God as having a long white beard and, you know, running around in some kind of robe, no, I don't think it's that metaphor. But I do think it is a larger concept of mind. You know, we are in the mind of God. The universe, is in the mind of God. In other words, we are getting into extraordinary confirmation of extraordinary possibilities that other generations could only think and wonder about. And we've got real data to work with.
But the Creator. You know, somebody called last hour and quoted a Bible passage in which God seemed to be saying in the Bible that man will have this ability. I couldn't even begin to, you know, I wouldn't even try to paraphrase
the quote.
Well,
that's a long discussion about who wrote what when, and I don't want to go down that path tonight.
Well, no, but my question was the Creator. In other words, is this a power enabled through their Creator, or only in a much broader sense?
Well, I think it's the power inherent in any conscious mind, given that we're not limited to this three-dimensional existence.
Okay, look, well, then let me try it another way. We're in such tough territory here. You know, I've always believed that God helps those who helps them, who help themselves, right? And so maybe it's some of both. Let me ask you this way, Richard. Does it work for the same reason that prayer works? You know the experiments that have gone on with prayer, right? When somebody has prayed, when they have a control group of people who are prayed for, who have an illness, the same illness is in on the other side, and they pray for the control group, and or for the target group, and they come out with much, much higher cure rates. Now, how is this concentration in any way different from prayer to God for something like this?
Well, I think that the Consciousness Project at Princeton, in their subtitle of their project, kind of says it. It's called the Global Consciousness Project, Registering Coherence and Resonance in the World. And if you get all these separate minds to resonate, to be on the same wavelength, to think about the same thing at the same time. Let me give you what I think is a stunning real-world example. And this is the first time I've ever discussed this with anybody. We'll be on the air tonight with, you know, 20 million of our most intimate friends, right, Art?
Yes.
We've all watched George Bush for the last year or so, 9 months. And a lot of us, you and me and others, basically thought, you know, before the election, this guy's just not going to cut it. He's just not up to the job. He's just this nice, friendly frat boy that you like to have a few beers with. For God's sake, sitting in the Oval Office, give me a break. And I've been watching, like a hawk, all the media. You know, we got wall-to-wall TV screens and satellite television and CNN and all that, so you can watch any sparrow fall anywhere, even in the middle of Afghanistan tonight. And I've been watching the transformation of George W. Bush.
No question about it.
And everybody from the New York Times to Time Magazine to Brian Williams to Geraldo to Wolf Blitzer, everybody has commented, this is a different person.
Well,
we saw before September 11th.
Richard, somehow America, when it's in great distress, seems to get, and I guess we're blessed by God or whatever you want to believe, we seem to get the person appropriate to the job. When something extraordinary comes along, somebody rises somehow to the job. It's happened again and again in America.
It's not a somehow. I'm going to lay out the model of what I think's going on.
Okay.
And it connects to what we just did with Rush.
But there's so much history for it, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, but just because we haven't monitored it and didn't know what was going on doesn't mean it didn't happen. Let me lay out the model, all right? And I want people to think about this.
Sure.
We have now poll data over and over and over again. George Bush has the highest poll ratings of any president in history.
Right.
Even beyond his father, 95%, 98%,
right,
something like that.
Right.
I'm going to propose tonight that what's happened is that this man has become the focus of millions upon millions upon millions of linked minds, all wishing him the absolute best in extricating us from this horrible morass we're in.
I'm sure you're right.
And most people are feeling really good about George Bush right now.
That's right.
In fact, there was a poll tonight that said that 70-20, they would prefer George be in the Oval Office than Bill Clinton.
Yes.
A guy who had very high poll ratings a few months ago. So I'm going to propose that the transformation we're seeing in the president is because everybody is focusing this incredible positive resonance lifting him up by his bootstraps,
yeah.
bringing out what was within him but never had a chance to blossom. And he has become an orator. He has become funny. He's become casual. He's become comfortable.
He's just risen to it.
He suddenly filled the presidency as like FDR did. But see, if you go back and look at these huge nexus points in history where you had huge events and people required real leadership.
And you had huge people.
I would propose that what you did with... I mean, Lincoln was a pipsqueak before Civil War.
I can absolutely buy into every bit of this, Richard. Every bit of it.
I'm saying we are making George Bush what we want him to be.
Yes.
And we're evoking the potential within him that nothing ever tapped before. And
that's an
ongoing experiment we're watching on global television.
All of this may be a far larger power than any powerful bomb we could ever drop.
Because it's the power of positive, Norman Vincent Peale, thinking. And a positive idea is 10,000 times more energetic than a negative idea.
Well, brace yourself, because here's where I'm going to disagree. I'm going to disagree here with you, Richard. I'm not going to indulge it, nor think about it, nor try it. But I believe that this power is simply a power. Now, I may be all wet on this, but I think that you could concentrate on a negative event, trying to cause a negative event, and wield the same kind of power, if you wished, in that negative way. I think this is just a power, and like any other power, Richard, it's my view it can be used either way.
The problem is, Art, you can't get millions of people to think negatively.
Well, it would depend.
That's what Hitler was trying to do. That was the whole occult, magical side of the SS.
And to some great degree, he succeeded.
He succeeded to a degree.
But, Richard,
who won?
If the cause was right, and I don't want to do this, but if, for example, you wanted to concentrate on breaking a critical blood vessel in the head of Osama bin Laden deep in his cave and kill the guy, I think it could be done. This is an area I will not enter. I simply will not enter. But I'm just trying to point out that it is my belief, and, you know, beliefs are like belly buttons, Richard, but I think it's just a power. It could be used any way at all if you could convince people. Convince them.
Well, this gets into the substance of this paper that, as you know, because you call me like every day for two or three days.
Yeah, that's because I'm very excited about this, as you know.
And I said, no, we're not ready yet, because I wanted to finish writing this thing that we published on the web on October 9th, which is the, if it goes by the title, Who's the Enemy, Really?, where we investigate a whole series of historical connections going back 1,000 years, literally 1,000 years before the horrible events of September 11th. And we also look at the Princeton experiment in the context of what were they really trying to achieve. And frankly, Art, you have put your finger on a very important aspect, because from our work in the HD model and from our work on the alignments, remember all these alignments people keep making terrible noises about and screwing up their noses and faces when I bring them up.
Oh, yes.
I believe that what bin Laden et al. Were trying to do, and what the numbers demonstrate, is they were trying to do in the negative what we tonight have been doing in the positive.
Well, then, to some degree, you prove my point.
And they were trying to do it by not doing it any old random time, but picking certain key celestial windows of opportunity when the physics is right to leverage their effect so that they could warp the consciousness and literally bend the future to their will.
Mm-hmm.
This is more powerful than the atomic bomb. You understand that?
Yes, I think I do.
You understand that if you've done it 7 times. You did it with me. I was, according to the doctors, dead. I didn't find this out for a couple of years because Robin wouldn't tell me, but, you know, she was with the doctors outside my room, and they're basically saying, well, he may not last till morning and stuff like that. And of course, I'm blissfully ignorant that they've written me off.
You remember when it hit, don't you?
I know exactly. I remember it vividly. You know, it's microsecond by microsecond.
All right, Richard, hold tight. We'll be back after the top of the hour. Listen to me now. Here comes the great experiment number two tonight, part number two. I want you to close your eyes during this news break, and I want you to intensely concentrate on the following. Randomness, as generated by the computers, is generally represented graphically or on a computer screen by TV noise. You know, like your TV when there's no, when there's nothing hooked up, no cable, you just get that white flickering noise. That's random noise. I want you to concentrate as hard as humanly possible during this break on first the random noise and then the random noise going away. Make it solid. Make it a solid black screen, a solid red screen, anything you want, any solid color. That represents total non-randomness. And I want you to center it over Princeton at Princeton, New Jersey, over the college campus. You're turning randomness into non-randomness, and we're going to knock their needle right off the peg. Let us begin now.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001. Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 18, 2001.
More powerful than the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb, maybe so. Maybe so. I've seen it work again and again and again. Now Princeton's doing the real work, and we've got about another 2 minutes to do this. And again, the easy way to do this, and it really is easy, if you want to be part of this experiment, it's your last opportunity. During the next 2 minutes of commercials, simply close your eyes. Imagine that white flickering stuff on the screen with no antenna connected. Then imagine over Princeton, New Jersey, over the campus of Princeton, all of a sudden that white noise going away and becoming a solid color, any color of your choice, but solid, non-random. Make all that red. Drive with your brain. Drive that randomness away and produce a solid color. Drive that randomness away. Picture it happening in your mind and make it solid. That's very non-random, folks, and that should drive their needles right off the chart. So, beginning right now, do it one last time, and then we are done for tonight.
Streamlink, the audio subscription service of Coast to Coast AM, has a new name. Coast Insider. You'll still get all the same great features for the same low price. The package includes podcasting, which automatically downloads shows for you, and the iPhone app. You'll also get our amazing download library of 3 full years of shows. That's over 1,000 shows for you to collect and enjoy. If you're a fan of Coast, you won't want to be without Coast Insider. Visit coasttocoastam.com to sign up. Looking for the truth? You'll find it on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, Jesse, people just don't want to believe that government is screwing them up. They just don't want to believe it.
They want to believe the government is looking out for your best interests. Well, I got news for you. Government is made up of people, and people can be corrupted, and evil people can get in power, and for some reason, nobody wants to admit that somehow the United States government could be evil.
Now, we take you back to the night of October 18th, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
All right, Richard, the experiments have been concluded, and what will happen will happen. We'll see.
Well, we'll find out in about 48 hours. I asked Dean if he could do it in real time, and he says with no notice there was no way, but
right.
They'll look at the data tomorrow. It'll take him probably a day to really crunch the numbers, and unless there's some really wow signals, which who knows, there might be. By the way, I found out what PAIR means.
What does it mean?
Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research, Department
okay.
of Engineering, Princeton University.
Okay.
Just want to get that in, because these people are doing some phenomenal stuff. And the coolest part is they are totally independent of what we've been looking at, and they have asked us to solve a major problem. Well, in the break, I went and looked in my computer in Redshift for the problem that they apparently are kind of puzzled by.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I know what's going on.
Let's hear it.
Well, I don't want to... That's not protocol. I told them I would tell them first. So as soon as I tell them, then I can tell everybody else.
All right.
But I think in the... Let me just give you a hint.
I really hate secrets.
I know you do. It looks celestial. And this is what the HD model has said. In other words, because of the way this physics works, because of the way you open these doorways between dimensions, so information can be communicated between one mind or another,
mm-hmm.
or one group of people and another, or one machine and another, you have to have the right geometry with these spinning objects in this thing we call the solar system. And this geometry replicates on a series of cycles, be they a month, a few years, decades, centuries, whatever, you have these repeating cycles. Everybody knows about the sunspot cycle. Everybody knows the moon goes around the Earth in about 1 month.
Suppose I were to cut through it for a second, and I were to say that I've been talking to somebody I respect recently, mm-hmm. who has told me, oh my God, Art, Sitchin was right.
Okay. In what respect?
That there is going to be... There's going to be something that Father Martin talked about with regard to 3 days and night, or three days of darkness, that there's going to be some information soon regarding a celestial body.
Yes.
And he, in the last part of the conversation, he said, oh my God, Sitchin is right. I'll have more on this. Talk about keeping secrets. But I just wonder if that resonates with anything that you're thinking.
Well, it would if it's a rather massive object that twirls through the solar system once every X number of years
well,
and then replicates a set of geometric configurations with the ordinary members of the solar system that we all know and love so well.
Yes.
In other words, what I've said from the get-go is we kind of figured out the baseline of HD physics, hyperdimensional physics,
uh-huh.
is that this works in a series of windows. People have said to me, well, why would NASA be doing things when Sirius is at 19.5 and 33 or on the horizon? And the answer is that there's no real physical effect from that configuration. What it is an historical symbolic memory of the fact that there is a real physics based on real alignments,
right.
which works, which creates certain conditions that you can measure, that can literally alter reality. Now, up until a couple weeks ago, before I learned the Princeton guys, I only knew this as a theoretical possibility. Now that we've got real data and they have offered to match their data against our windows, I mean, this is pretty heavyweight stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Real university scientists, real computers, real academics, real work, real thinking, and we'll have some wondrous correlations that will blow their minds and other people's minds, because we now believe we understand the configurations that actually work, that mean something, that are not just symbolic. A lot of the stuff that you and I have talked about over the years, Art, terms of NASA doing things, launching things, or flying by when these things were at certain angles, is strictly symbolic. It's almost like a shorthand. It's almost like a code. You know, we're all very concerned now that Bin Laden is going to give us all codes through appearing on television, on CNN. Well, this is a real code, and it's right in front of us, and only a very few people know how to figure it out because the basis of this has been lost in the mists of history. Well, what the Princeton group has got is a set of detectors, sensors, if you want to go to the Star Trek analogy, that allow us for the first time to actually measure the bending of reality, the changing of the physical constants on a predictive basis. And if you go to their website, which of course is linked through this long article that I put up on our site tonight, you will find a ton of experiments where they have done formal predictions of various events all over the world.
Okay, so you've gone and let me go to my own website here, Richard, and look at program, tonight's guest info. Let me see Richard's name and Who's the Enemy, The End of Days.
That's the one.
Who's the Enemy? Okay, under Richard's name, Who's the Enemy, The End of Days Begun, question mark. Click on that, and the article he just referenced will be right there.
And it takes you ultimately down toward the bottom when we get to Princeton, to the Princeton site.
Right.
You roam the Princeton site. You look at all their previous 4 or 5 years of experiments. You look at their protocols. You look at the hits they've made, the misses they've made. What's most fascinating to me, Art, is, and this is going to be controlled tonight, what we've done, you know, first you doing it with Rush and then doing ours, we did not plan this in advance. You did not sit down with your little copy of Redshift
that
I gave you many years ago.
Absolutely not.
And plan to do this with certain key alignments, right?
No, that's right.
So it's a strictly random experiment. Let me tell you what my prediction is going to be. Unless we randomly hit a window, which I don't think we did because they're not that often.
Oh, here's the chart showing the, oh my God.
Yes.
Oh my God. The terrorist attacks. When the terrorist attack occurred, this thing went.
Look at that.
Oh my God.
And look at how it begins to rise hours before the event.
Yeah, let me see. According to this, Richard, let's see. I see. These are times on the bottom, right? Eastern Standard Time. All right.
And the probability of it being random chance is on the left. On the, x-axis?
Right.
The up-axis?
Right. Holy crapola. This is astounding, folks. And this is a measurement of the non-randomness, essentially.
Of all these 39 little guys all over the world feeding their data back through the Internet to the Princeton computer.
Holy mackerel, Richard. All right, you can get to this by going to artbell.com. Go to program, tonight's guest info. You'll see the name Richard Hoagland. Just click on Who's the Enemy, The End of Days, Begun, question mark. And then as you go down the screen, you will finally get to this graph that will blow your mind. That's all of you folks. That's all of us on that day. That's astounding, Richard.
Well, it's astounding because if you look at the rest of the long article, and it's very long with lots of links, lots of documentation, it goes back 1,000 years. It charts this problem we're having in the Middle East with these maniacs, going back to a group called the Order of the Assassins, literally 1,000 years ago, actually on the very day of the event,
yes,
which happened on 9/11,
yes,
you know, famous 9/11. The Assassins were formed in 1090 A.D. If you subtract 1090 A.D. from 2001, you get 9/11. These people are ultimately up to their eyebrows, Bin Laden et al., in ceremonial magic. They believe they can affect history by doing terrible negative things like we discussed a few minutes ago within these windows, these time windows. They're trying to perform by killing 7,000 people on global television an awful version of the positive experiments we have conducted tonight.
Again, proving my point, I'm sorry to say.
Well, it's look, technology or physics is neutral.
Yeah, that's what
I
think, too. It's just, it is a power. It is a mighty power.
And it's called free will.
And
that's right. About God, it's called free will.
And it can be used either way.
It can be used either. But yeah. I will say that it's a lot easier to get a bunch of people together for a positive effect
yeah.
than it is for a negative effect.
I agree. Although evil minds have managed it, witness Hitler and many others.
Yeah, but they need help. They need these windows. They need brownie points. They need to ace the bet. And, you know, this probably works in terms of linking consciousness at any old time. It just works a lot more efficiently if you do it in the right window. Going back to how the physics of the universe really works in our local neighborhood, which, of course, is the only neighborhood we happen to live in at the moment. So let me go back to a couple of things. As we were going through this historical dissection of the awful, I mean, you and I talked, and you know I felt like shit. Can you say that on the air? I mean, it was a horrendous, mind-wrenching, numbing, depressing thing, and it took me about a month to really kind of feel semi-myself again as I'd watched this and I watched all the ancillary effects and all that. And
oh, I know.
Part of what I was trying to do in writing this piece was work therapy, because if this project has any contribution to make to the well-being of humankind, it is to figure out the baselines of what's going on here so that the good guys can use it to prevent the bad guys from using it ever again. And I am extremely pleased to report tonight, and I have to be very careful how I say this, that we have had some very serious people in the administration looking at our data, particularly at this article we've written on the web. And I got a couple of calls tonight, and they said you can say that there is a intrigued interest in this as a predictive technique, as a predictive tool, in companion with the Princeton data, to allow us to prevent this from ever happening again. And I am extraordinarily gratified at this, because I worked very long and hard, as you know, and there have been a lot of people making faces and saying nasty things about what we're trying to do.
You know what the really good thing about this is, Richard? The government really can't use it. Only we can use it.
Oh, people are, you know,
only,
you gotta have
only
a lot of
people
thinking,
talk about people power. I mean, only
it's the ultimate expression of democracy.
That's right. That's exactly
that's
right.
What the founders, the framers, you know, remember the framers were into this stuff. George Washington was a 33rd degree Mason, and I know you make fun of Masons. Well, Masons,
I do not.
Some Masons, not everybody, but a few, know a lot that they don't talk about.
Because I do not make fun of Masons, Richard.
I do not.
People who call me say things, but I don't make fun of Masons. Not me.
Well, there are things that are known, and there are things that are suspected, and then there are things that almost nobody knows about. And when you're dealing with this kind of power, remember, this is a real physics and technology, if we're correct. It is more powerful than the H-bomb. And with that kind of power, would you want just anybody using it for the negative effects that we discussed shortly, you know, just a while ago?
Of course not.
So I am of the belief, and I'm not alone, people like my friend Graham Hancock, who did a lot of research on the Templars and the, you know, the Mason connection and all that, believes that when the Templars were hanging out there for several hundred years on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, having arrived there in 1118, suddenly, dramatically, and demanded basically that they be allowed to dig, and they sat on that, you know, hill, and for till 1127, which is what, 4 or 5 years, they did nothing but excavate on the Temple Mount under what was the first and second temple of Solomon.
Richard, that this power would be known to ancient organizations and even protected as some sort of important secret, that doesn't surprise me for one second. I'm sure that mankind has always had this power, since mankind has been around, and that its use might be a secret piece of knowledge protected by an organization. Does that surprise me? Absolutely not.
Well, a lot of people will think 1,000 years is a long time. It's not. It's yesterday. What we're projecting, based on the work of Graham and others, is that the Templars found documents or information buried under that hill, sacred information that had been carefully preserved by the Jewish priesthood, that had come from much, much earlier. I mean, we're talking basically Atlantis-type stuff, which brings me to another thing I have to tell you tonight, and I can tell you on the air.
I'll bet you there's records of it below the church in Rome.
I would not be at all surprised.
Right.
One of my sources tonight, again connected to the administration, you know, proven track record, says keep your eyes on Cuba. The stuff going on off Cuba,
yes,
half a mile down,
yes,
is absolutely real. And there is a tremendous confluence of experts now being quietly brought in. They are trying to do dating. They've got photographs. They have corings. I asked, obviously, when the hell are we all going to hear about this? And he says, well, give us a couple of weeks and maybe I can give you a date.
Good luck. I've got feelers out everywhere, Richard, and all I get back from all of them is, yes, hey, brother, this one's really real,
well,
and it's really big, and it's really going to break, and it's really being controlled right now. That's what I get.
Well, the reason it's relevant is because if we're looking, and by the way, you know one of the dates that he floated by me tonight, and we agree they probably don't know because they don't have the background to really do the dating. I mean, you can't date stone. You can't date metal.
Right.
So you have to date correlative things like organics.
Mm-hmm.
They're estimating, this is going to blow your socks off, Art, they're estimating now that this stuff down there half a mile below, you know, off Cuba, below the surface of the ocean, is 50,000 years old.
Hmm.
I'm betting it's
Richard, how would you imagine it got down that far? Because we all know even during the last ice age, you could account for maybe 900 feet.
Exactly.
At 300 feet, at very best, in change in ocean levels.
In terms of ice age, change of ocean.
So here we have something down a half a mile that may represent a whole ancient city, and the $64 gazillion question is how it could possibly, how, even at, what, 50,000 years or whatever age, it could have gone down that far. That's okay. Absolutely, it's just flat out impossible. Don't answer until after the break.
Okay. Can do.
Hold it right there. How could it have gotten down that far? Something really big had to have happened. Something that we have no particular reference for. Maybe in the exploration, maybe National Geographic and others who are looking will find out exactly what did happen. I think Richard has a couple of his own ideas about how it may have happened. We'll check that out. And, oh, we've got Daniel Golden ahead yet. So keep it right where you've got it, from the high desert. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001.
You told me
Premier Radio Networks presents Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired October 18th, 2001.
Tonight we have conducted some historic experiments. There is no doubt about it. You want to see something that will really blow your mind? I mean, really blow your mind? Trust me on this. Go to my website, artbell.com. Go to program and tonight's guest info. Look for the name Richard C. Hoagland. By all means, click on the link just below his name, the one that says, "Who's the enemy? The end of days begun?" Question mark. It's a very long, long article, and as you go down toward the bottom of the page after it loads, you will see some graphs from Princeton, and they show the 9/11 event on a graph like a seismograph, just like a seismograph. It was good to imagine that. Because that's the way it looks. And beginning a few hours before the event, they chart the hours here, and after the event, you will see the most incredible spike representing us, human consciousness, folks. We did that. That's the collective consciousness you're seeing on a chart. And it's gone through the roof. And what we did tonight was to experiment with driving it up there again. Perhaps not as high. But if we can prove, and I think we can, what we just did and have been doing for years, though it's been a few because I've been afraid of it, then we may be on our way to proving a power greater than that of the hydrogen bomb. That's really something to consider, isn't it? Anyway, we gave it the, no pun intended, good old college try. We'll be right back.
Now we take you back to the night of October 18th, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Once again, to the mountains of New Mexico, and Richard C. Hoagland, what a fascinating topic tonight. Absolutely fascinating. Okay,
because
Richard.
It makes everything you've done, Art, and all the topics and people that you've had on take on a whole new meaning. We now have a way to measure the unmeasurable up till now.
That's it. That really is it. You're right. And you know something, Richard? I don't have to measure it to know that it's true, but it nevertheless fascinates and comforts me to know that it can be measured. I never for one second doubted that it was true, and I don't need the charts to believe it, but the charts are effing amazing.
They really are. I mean, look, my friend and yours, Danian, and I are living proof that this works. But if you want graphical proof, you look at those graphs. You then look at the timing, you know, when you read the article, you'll see the incredible timing these, you know, I can't even describe them on the air appropriately, put into planning this event, taking the planes, not hijacking the planes immediately. They waited. They waited for certain time windows so that this celestial geometry would match their diabolical intent. Mm-hmm. To have the maximum leverage. You're looking at that leverage. Look at that, the size of that graph.
If you think that's leverage, and it was, but look at this whole incredible anthrax thing, Richard. And nobody would minimize the fact that one person has died and many others have been either exposed or injured in that they're now ill from this. But, you know, numerically, as I said earlier, in perspective, 20,000 people a year die of flu. So,
and 25,000 die of what? Of car crashes.
But look at the leverage they've achieved by sending this anthrax to the media giants.
You got it.
Man, it's been nothing but, and you
got
just
it.
Know
and
the collective
again,
spike has been...
By the way, I'm glad you brought this up, because before we get too far into the night, I want to make a very important statement. You had Linda on a few days ago.
Right.
Describing the remarkable work going on at the University of Michigan.
Yes.
And Dr. Baker.
Yes.
And his discovery of nano bomb technology.
Right. That's being sort of put up on the shelf.
Which is basically on the shelf. Well, you know, Enterprise has very long tentacles, and it turns out that one of my dearest and closest associates in our project is a very close friend of Tommy Thompson, the current Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Who appeared on 60 Minutes a couple weeks ago, yes.
Yep. So what I asked this person to do was to take the material from the Center for Nanobiology at the University of Michigan on Dr. Baker's breakthrough discovery, which, for those who weren't tuned in, you know, a few weeks ago, this basically is a non-invasive, completely benign treatment that consists of a kind of an emulsified salad dressing of detergent, oil, soybean oil, and a few other things, and you spray it around where there is danger of microorganism contamination, be it, you know, syphilis, anthrax, spotted fever, the flu. You know, it works on viruses and bacteria.
And it eats that stuff up.
It blows them up.
Yeah, blows them up.
Literally, because of surface tension, it's a mechanical device. It kind of is on the microbiological level. It's kind of like a laser-guided smart bomb.
Yeah, it's a nano bomb. That's what they call
it. And it mechanically seeks out these little beasties, and because they don't have the same surface tension as your normal cells, they explode when they're enveloped by this micro enzymed oil.
Well, the important thing for people to understand is this is not future shock.
No.
This is not something, this is not science fiction or something we're imagining for the future.
Nope.
This is here now.
It was funded by DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is a part of the DOD, the Department of Defense. It was tested by the Army a few months ago. It has not gone through FDA trials and certification, which is the huge barrier now to widespread use. They're talking, we have, 2 million doses of this anthrax vaccine, which you could only get to a few people if there was a huge terrorist problem.
Right.
And it costs, it's going to cost thousands of dollars per ounce because of the huge demand and the huge fear factor, which has been built up in the last several weeks. This stuff that Dr. Baker has produced could be available for 70 cents per pound. And it doesn't have any side effects.
Per pound.
70 cents per pound. Which, of course, is one reason why no one's beating a path to Dr. Baker's door, because they're not going to make a fortune on it. You know, there's already profiteering and greed in this war on terrorism. So here's what we've done. I had my friend send this material directly to Tommy Thompson a couple days ago.
Right.
We then got his website and his office fax number in Washington, D.C., the same gambit we ran with Dan Golan at NASA. We're going to run with Tommy Thompson. So if you go to my website, you will see, or Art Bell's website, you will see another link up there which says Anthrax Treatment. I believe that's what the title is. It has anthrax in the title. If you read that, it's a very short piece. It's like one page. We have a whole series of fax numbers and emails for you to do, and there's a protocol we're recommending. You basically fax your demand to Tommy Thompson.
Drop the nanobomb now.
Exactly. That it be put through accelerated FDA trials, like they've done with some of the HIV stuff. They've cut all the bureaucratic corners, and it's come out in less than a month.
I suppose, Richard, anything so powerful as this nanobomb is said to be would really be put through a big regimen of testing, because one can imagine possible side effects that you might not anticipate. And, of course, if it went to work on something you didn't want it to go to work on, that could potentially be not so cool.
Well, Baker and his group at Michigan have actually done a lot of trials themselves, and
so
they know
pretty much
what the side effects are. The Army did trials, but it has to go through the last bureaucratic hurdle, which is the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. Here is Tommy Thompson's fax number in his office.
Okay.
It is 202-690-7203. That's 202. That's the Washington, D.C. area code. 690-7203.
It's a public fax.
His office, yeah. HSS fax number, Health and Human Services. Remember, he is the guy who was front and center in the war on terrorism on the home front, you know, under the president, who is basically, you know, he sits in front of these committees and says, we're ready to respond, and the senators say, you know, will you still love me if I tell you I don't believe you?
So say, drop the nanobomb now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I would also recommend, as per our previous extraordinarily successful results with NASA, that you simultaneously send the same facts to a whole list of people, and we have them on the website. You know, Capitol Hill, senators, congressmen, the White House, the president, of course, you know, he's not aware of this. But the media is very important. Remember, the media now are on the front line of this war. Peter Jennings has had staff people thick. You know, Dan Rather today said that he had a very valued staff person
to come
down with this.
Yeah,
Tom Brokaw.
Right.
The only network they haven't attacked yet is CNN, and I'm sure that's going to happen. So here's what you want to do. You want to send simultaneous copies of your faxes to Secretary Thompson, to people like Ted Koppel.
And you've got all those numbers
and
out.
All those numbers are on the website.
All right.
And we also have other people listed we haven't talked about before. Bill O'Reilly is becoming a hero of mine. Bill O'Reilly was the guy who discovered, remember the stockbroker, the bond broker, who cried on every network and had lost 700 people in this catastrophe? And it turned out from the results of O'Reilly's investigation that he had cut off their salaries to their wives and widows and orphan children now. And it was O'Reilly who basically broke the story. So you want to email to O'Reilly@FoxNews.com. The same thing with Tom Brokaw. Send it to Nightly@NBC.com or The Today Show. Let's get Katie Couric and...
Right, investigate the nanobomb. Find out what it is and get it more widely known across America that it is available and that it should be rushed through.
Now,
not dangerously rushed, but we need to get it through because it will kill this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Now, the neat part is that it works on all of these potential bioterrorist threats. Because it isn't genetic specific. It is not a molecular attack. It is a mechanical attack. It literally engulfs the microorganism and explodes it.
Well, you know, Richard, we've got our own stock, and I know they'll say not, of biological and chemical weapons, but I know damn well we do.
We do.
And so it threatens our strategic capability in this arena as well. It's no small matter.
Look, remember the old concept of blowback?
Oh, yes.
You know, when you use it on the other guys, the wind's going to change and it's going to blow back on your guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, this has been called the poor man's atomic bomb for a good reason.
Yeah, the trouble, though, is that we have people in the world now that don't care about blowback.
Well, here's where our experiments come in, because...
they're ready to die.
By the same token that 90% are supporting the president, and I believe making him live up to his best expectations... if 90% of the people listening to us tonight were to get behind this idea, it's unstoppable. Remember, this is a real-world physics. We've got data now that shows you can change the curve. You can literally bend reality. Well, let's think positively. You know, the idea that this could be so empowering to people, giving them something physically important to do,
sure,
is, to me, the most interesting ray of sunshine in this whole horrible mess that I've had in like a month.
It's true, because people have felt powerless to do anything about this. Even our government, to some degree, is powerless, and so we feel that way, too. A sort of a shadowy enemy who might be hiding in caves somewhere. How the hell do you fight that?
I was very proud of Dan today, who I have not seen in a long time, you know, when he took over from Walter. But he said, you know, in a very statesmanlike manner that, you know, he almost echoed FDR, that the single biggest problem we have in this is not the terrorists, it's not the mail, it's none of this piddly stuff, it's the fear. We must get on top of
fear. That's right.
It cannot be allowed to paralyze us. It cannot be allowed to stop us from achieving what the American experience is supposed to achieve, which is to open up the system for more people to allow them to experience the benefits that we experience.
Well, I tried myself to minimize the fear by putting it in perspective with respect to, you know, the number of people who die of flu every year. However, having said that, I am a little bit concerned that, Richard, you know, we now know of X number of cases and places that have been hit. I would bet that we only know about a small portion of it so far. In other words, I'm thinking a lot of other people may have been infected, and we just don't know about it yet. We don't know the scale of the attack yet.
Well, we cannot let that paralyze us.
Absolutely not. No. Even if it was 10 times bigger than it is now, which it might be, That would still be, in scale, tiny compared to other maladies we suffer.
What I find is extraordinary, and this is going to be a political comment. I'm going to probably piss some people off tonight before we get off the air, because I want to have my say on a number of things. And as you know, I'm not as what's his name said, a potted plant. I have my ideas. I'm
not you've done it for
correct.
Years. Don't let it stop you now.
When I saw the first outbreaks in Florida at American Media, which I know and most people did not know, publishes the three big tabloids, the Globe, the Inquirer, and the Star.
Right.
I instantly knew what the strategy was, because those are the biggest mass circulation newspapers in the world.
Strategy is terror.
And I knew that it was terror for the media. If you want to guarantee that this will piggyback on every cable station, on every satellite network, on every broadcast network.
Who do you attack?
You attack the media.
That's it.
And what was astonishing is that it took them almost 2 weeks to figure out that they were the center of the attack. And even today, there is a hesitancy to understand this is coordinated for a particular purpose. It is leveraged psychological terrorism.
Tonight CNN was busily picking itself apart, as it should, and the other networks should too. And Dan Rather was commenting with Larry tonight, and I think appropriately asking, have we disproportionately reported this story? And I think the answer is clearly yes.
Absolutely.
It's irresistible for the media.
If one-tenth of the audience you have tonight, right now, go to the web, have computers, go to the web, read this piece we've got up there, take down those fax and email numbers and addresses, and send their response to Washington and the media, there is something that we really can do. You do not have to sit paralyzed, huddling under the bed, waiting for the envelope to come in the front door, and it ain't Ed McMahon. This is something that is proactive, which is real, which is a stunning breakthrough. And if you go to a Dr. Baker's site and read his background, read his colleagues' work, read all the other developments that they have waiting in the wings in this nanotechnology area.
Yes.
I mean, it is an extraordinarily uplifting, positive, proactive.
Oh, I know. I've had a whole lot of very informed guests on the subject of nanotechnology. But the difference here is this isn't future shock. This isn't science fiction. This is here and ready to go to work and kill this crap now. It'll work now. It is working now. It's already done. It's accomplished. All they would have to do is finish testing and distribute it, and it would end a lot of our present
problems. It is a political problem. It is amenable to a political solution.
Sure.
And if there's one thing this audience can do, Art, is create a political solution. We've done it before. Let's do it again. And the details are on our website, and they're linked through your site.
Well, that's plenty to get them busy with tonight, Richard. It's been a full night, and it's going to get fuller, because I want to ask you in a moment about, shockingly, normally we'd have been on this story as a lead headline story, but there's just so much other stuff going on that Dan Golden's resigning from NASA, it got somewhere in the middle of the Associated Press news feed the other night, and now it's gone. But Dan Golden has resigned.
Suddenly.
And it would be dramatically as well, and it would be gigantic news any other time. It's just that we're so overwhelmed with everything else that it's fallen between the cracks. And an obvious person to comment on this is you. And I know you, at least I hope you have comments on it, don't you?
Of course I do. Well, several things.
Not yet. Hold your comments until after the top of the hour.
The pregnant pause.
The pregnant pause. The irresistible hook. Richard, hold it right there. We'll be right back. We are America. There is no problem we can't go around or solve.
Ain't got no trouble in my life.
Listen to the words.
No foolish dream to make me cry.
It kind of tells a story.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001.
Yeah.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 18, 2001.
It's been a great experiment night. My guest is Richard C. Hoagland. We're talking about all kinds of things. In a moment, the resignation of Dan Golden. How you doing? Hanging in there tonight? Hope so. Trying to get your mind off what's going on out there a little bit anyway. Isn't that nice?
Streamlink, the audio subscription service of Coast to Coast AM, has a new name, Coast Insider. You'll still get all the same great features for the same low price. The package includes podcasting, which automatically downloads shows for you, and the iPhone app. You'll also get our amazing download library of 3 full years of shows. That's over 1,000 shows for you to collect and enjoy. If you're a fan of Coast, you won't want to be without Coast Insider. Visit coasttocoastam.com to sign up. Weird stories on the radio? Must be Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, when I started doing this radio program, Jesse, half of the subjects I was really into, the paranormal, the unusual, ghosts, and things like that.
Yeah.
The conspiracy stories, you know, I was a little weary about these, other than the Kennedy assassination. And all of a sudden, I woke up. I simply woke up. Is that what happened with you two?
Yeah, that's when I really started to say, what is going on here? And I started to truly then investigate 9/11. And today, I don't believe the government story of 9/11. Here's the three options. Either we knew about it and allowed it to happen, or we knew about it and participated in it, or these were the dumbest buffoons that could have ever been in charge of our country, who could have all this pre-information. And I started to think they knew what was going to happen. They either are part of it or they allowed it to. There's no doubt in my mind.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001.
Once again, to the dark, tall mountains of New Mexico in the middle of the night, and Richard C. Hoagland, Dan Golden has resigned. Were you surprised when you heard that?
Yes, I did. Well, there was no warning. We have known that he was thinking about it, that there had been, you know, discussions, that he'd been there 10 years, he'd served through three presidents, you know, George Sr., Clinton, and then George Jr.
Right.
In fact, he said the other day, very ironically, at his own farewell press conference, that he'd served, 9 months and 20 days under senior President Bush, mm-hmm. and 9 months, 27 days under the current President Bush, and he thought that was good bookends for a career.
I'm so not going to ask you to comment on that. I know exactly what you think of that.
Well, the thing I think most intriguing is that he's quitting on November 17th,
uh-huh.
which if you read our piece on the web that has the Princeton data and a lot of other stuff, you'll see that we're looking at something pretty bizarre that might or might not happen on the 17th of November.
He knows what other people who know the secret may know.
Well, given that a lot of the stuff under his tutelage
right.
has gone according to the numbers.
He would have to know, Richard.
He would have to know.
If what you say is true,
yeah,
he would have to know. I agree with that.
So let me tell you what happened tonight. I got, as I said earlier, a call from one of my sources that has excellent contacts in the current administration.
Mm.
And so I asked him point blank. I said, what the hell is going on with Dan Golden?
Mm-hmm.
And I hoped I would have information, specific information, by airtime. Instead, it looks like everybody has been left flat-footed. There is no replacement. There is no rumor of a replacement.
Oh, you're right. I haven't heard a word about it.
No, this is not the way you do it. So the conjecture among, you know, the informed pundits, as they used to say on all the talk shows in Washington,
yes.
is that there has been some high-level policy disagreement between the White House and Mr. Golden,
and Mr. Golden was basically shown the door.
What do you think that disagreement might be, Richard?
Well, the timing is very interesting.
I'm just asking you to speculate.
Yeah, I'm
guess.
Not going to, but I want to give a little... Remember, I always do foundation.
I know.
People don't have the background that you and I do. Today, remember, he announced this resignation yesterday, effective 1 month from now, on the morning of November 17th.
Mm-hmm.
Today, JPL had a major press conference on the approaching insertion of Mars Odyssey, you know, Arthur Clarke's mission, into Mars orbit next Tuesday evening.
Yes.
And Dan Golden upstaged that event by one day by announcing the day before they were going to, you know, get all warm and fuzzy and talk about what they're doing.
That's very interesting, isn't it?
So he announced just before the announcement of the arrival of Mars Global, Mars Odyssey.
So upstaging that. That is weird. You know, you would think they'd coordinate that.
So let's say, what's that great line, you know, inquiring minds want to know?
Yeah.
Taking on a whole new meaning with this current rash of stuff. Inquiring minds are thinking that there is some policy disagreement. It possibly could revolve around what's going to happen with Mars Odyssey when it gets to Mars and what it's going to really show us and the things it can really test. Remember, it feels like years ago, but we published a very complicated paper on a Mars scenario for Mars being a former satellite of a larger planet.
Van Flandern's.
The Van Flandern model with variations, but basically Tom's idea.
Do you want to make a guess about what's going to happen with this mission, and it's just a guess? You want to make a guess based on what you know?
Well, in the paper, we listed a bunch of things we were projecting, that there's tidal evidence of it being tidally locked. No one had ever pointed that out before, that it has to have water.
Oh, yes.
The water has to be in these two bulges. Remember we went through
right. All
of that?
Oh, of course.
And then we said in the paper that Mars Odyssey, Arthur's dear little mission, has the unique set of instruments that can prove and test and demonstrate the validity of that model, provided they let the data out, provided they actually show us what they find. So that's what I've been looking forward to all summer. And in my conversations via email with my friend Arthur, who is, we've been twittering back and forth halfway around the world.
Yes, I know you've started up a rather recent communication with Arthur.
It's been too long since we talked, and, you know, Arthur never changes. You know, as long as I've known him, which is 30-some years, Arthur has not changed. And so we're both anticipating big things from Mars Odyssey.
Well, the only thing that I could think of right now that would actually upstage the current terror news so saturating our national media would be something like this. To suddenly announce, yes, there was or is life on Mars. Yes, there is water. Yes, there is foliage. Whatever it is that might come out of all this, that might just upstage what's going on right now.
And I find it intriguing that the keeper of the secrets for 10 years just resigned. And desperately hoping that, you know, as some of my compatriots told me even before the election, that if Bush was elected, we would have a new broom and an openness. And, you know, I don't know whether we ever discussed this, but back when George Sr. was president, and on that July 20th, another ceremonial date in 1989, stood on the steps of the Smithsonian and announced the Moon Mars Initiative.
Right.
We were going to go in 50 years, you know, first to the moon, then back to Mars, this time
that's
to stay.
Right.
Remember
that's
those
right.
ringing words?
Oh, of course.
And NASA and the Congress absolutely did their level best to destroy, to cut off at the knees, this whole idea. I was involved in a very weird way, because the night that he made this announcement, I was literally standing on the floor of Yosemite Valley in Northern California. Never been there. I'd taken a friend, you know, for a vacation. CNN tracked me down in the middle of nowhere and wanted me to appear on Crossfire opposite, you know, the counterpoint of view to explain why the president wanted to go to Mars and what there was there to go for.
Well, Richard, if they can track down their correspondents at nameless places in Afghanistan.
They
don't have any trouble finding Richard Hoagland.
Exactly. But here's an interesting thing. There are 50 zillion aerospace pundits in Washington, all right? there were all kinds of people who were on NASA payroll, former Air Force, NASA, whatever, aerospace industry. Why did CNN want me to come on to represent the president's reason for wanting to go to Mars?
Because they know you're a radical.
Because they knew I would say things about Sidonia.
That's
I would
right.
show the pictures of the
course.
Face and
oh,
all that.
That's right. They knew
In
that.
Other words, they wanted that on the air. So here was the spin before the election. My compatriots looking at that data said, if George Sr. wanted to do that and was cut off at the knees and not allowed to, maybe George Jr. is going to try to pick up where Dad left off and will complete the mission. And to do that, you have to give Dan Golden the heave-ho, because under the Clinton folks, he was the keeper of the secrets and sitting on the crown for 10 years. He was the one who was in the White in NASA, which basically helped cut off.
All right, Richard, when do you expect to see the three puffs of smoke from Houston? You know,
which is the analogy for the way they pick Pope.
Yeah, that's right.
Very good, very good.
Sorry.
Well, I am anticipating, you know, I'm talking to my sources, and as soon as we know, you'll know. Remember, what was it, Barbara says, you know, in 2020, you know, we're in touch, so you be in touch?
Yeah, yeah. So in other words, the choice they pick will really... It will tell us, won't it?
It will be straws in the wind, smoke in the sky, and in the midst of this new war on terrorism and an initiative, in other words, we're actually taking the bit in our teeth on a number of fronts. And it almost looks, I want to say almost because I don't want to believe it yet because I'm a very skeptical person on this, but it almost looks as if the politics may be getting in sync for the kind of disclosure of big things that have been kept under the rug for far too long. Law.
All right, let's have you stick your neck way out and say, if the old Mars hoax doesn't slap down this mission as it approaches Mars or enters the atmosphere, if the old hoax doesn't reach out and get it, and the mission is successful, what do you think they might likely find?
Well, it carries main instruments. It carries an imaging infrared camera.
Okay.
Which can take visible color images as well as infrared, like night scope images.
Yep.
It carries two radiation instruments, one of which has failed. The Maria instrument to measure radiation effects on human beings has, quote, failed.
I thought they got the backup going, though.
I saw today on the NASA site that they're going to work on it when they're in orbit.
Oh.
You know, NASA can do a lot of things by remote control. There's a lot of ways you can flip switches and send commands, and we don't know why it's failed yet, but... That's not the one I'm worried about. The one that they're carrying that's really interesting to me is the GRS experiment.
Which is?
The gamma ray spectrometer.
Which will do?
Which is a gadget which basically measures gamma rays. Okay?
Okay.
And the gamma rays come from the surface of Mars, produced by the interaction of cosmic rays with the soil and what's under the soil, and in particular... will interact with the hydrogen in the water molecule.
Okay, boil it down to English. What could that show us?
It will show us where the water is.
Oh.
And if the gamma ray spectrometer maps during the next couple year mission that it's supposed to
Richard, does that mean they could find water below the surface of Mars?
Within a few inches.
Oh,
it has to be very close.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But if it's ice, they'll find it. If it's liquid, they'll find it. Remember, we think all these stains, these weird dark streaks, are really liquid water.
Yes, which we have shown clearly on previous programs.
And Efron Palermo and Jill England and others have published a very neat paper on that at the Mars conference this summer.
Right.
But if for our model, for the Enterprise model, what we're proposing or we're promulgating is that the GRS will find that the water they find around close under the surface is in two lobes. Left and right on the planet with nothing in between, which is a classic signature of a tidal former Mars. Mars is a former satellite of a big guy.
Uh-huh.
That companion with the chlorophyll measurements that the camera can take.
Oh, they're going to take chlorophyll.
They will be viewing in the chlorophyll band, among other things. They will be photographing Arthur's bushes. Remember his
Arthur's
big life
bushes,
form.
Yeah. Richard, there shouldn't be, according to the model that we understand, any chlorophyll
at all
on Mars, should there?
Nope.
Zero. Zilch.
Yeah, zero.
So if they
now, there is a Russian guy.
If they were to find a lot of chlorophyll, didn't expect it.
It would be dynamite. It would be gangbusters. It would mean that Arthur's right. There is big vegetation.
Big life on Mars.
Big life on Mars.
Yeah.
It can also do things that are more in the artifact vein. One of our problems all these years is we've been looking basically at black and white pictures, right?
Oh, sure.
And when you look at a black and white picture, if you're looking at a landscape with cities covered with Mars dust, it basically looks the same. But if you have a multispectral camera, and it's got the 15 or 20 different bands, I believe, I haven't looked at the data for a while, but it can do a lot of discrimination, it can tell, even through dust, if it's not too thick, metal surfaces from rock surfaces.
Oh, my.
Which means we could be looking at pictures, and if they were honest and gave us the straight scoop, they would say, well, this is incredibly anomalous because it looks like highly refined metal.
Well, if even half of these things came true, Richard, if they found chlorophyll, if they found large amounts of water very close to the surface, or metal or artifacts or whatever in God's name they might find on Mars, that would be the key that would turn the money lock open. The public would go berserk. There would be an immediate manned mission to Mars with a suddenly pushed-up schedule. It could be the key that would turn the whole nation on, and we would be on our way to Mars. Do you think that's an understatement?
No, I think it's fairly down the middle of the freeway.
Yeah.
The precipitous, sudden departure of Golden on the eve of the announcement of the arrival next week of Mars Odyssey,
right,
to me is the most telling that scenario may not be that far off, given what we know is there. Remember, we've got a 20-year database of knowing there's wonderful, weird, bizarre, intelligently designed stuff sitting on Mars tonight, unequivocally.
Trouble with this is that the earlier Hoagland model would suggest that we're not going to get this information.
Unless we've had a sea state change. And
right.
With the same way that George is aggressively pursuing now terrorism anywhere it lives, is willing to... I mean, they're now talking about after Afghanistan, who's next?
Probably Iraq.
Which is... But that's not the point. The point is to be telegraphing that this ain't ending, this is simply beginning.
Right.
Indicates a level of seriousness, because we've been funding all these guys. This is what is so incredibly pathetic and tragic. We brought some of this on ourselves by funding the bin Ladens of the world.
I know, but look, Richard, it was a different world. And we were funding the Mujahideen to fight the Soviets, which at the time seemed like a pretty spiffy idea. I'll tell you why. Again, unfortunate, but perhaps at the time necessary. We didn't like what was going on in Iran. And if Iraq and Iran were at each other's throats, that was a pretty good thing. And I think we were very much afraid that if we got rid of Saddam, Iraq would become exactly like Iran.
My point is this.
My point, only in defense of what they did.
Fully understand. Look, what I'm saying is, if there has been a sea state change, if it is no longer business as usual, if the president and this administration, which were handpicked, remember, you couldn't have a better team surrounding the president than the team that's there to prosecute what's going on now.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. Think about the key players, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Powell. Think of the incredible prescience of having that team in place to handle this catastrophe and what has to happen next.
Oh, I know.
So if there is a plan to change the landscape, it's not business as usual, we're going to really root this out and change the way we do business, no more making lots of money off piles of bodies, but we're going to follow principle and make life safe for people and rebuild the shattered, war-torn country of Afghanistan, not leave it in the lurch. Remember how the president said no nation building?
I hope you're right.
Richard,
hold on. We're at the break point here, bottom of the hour. I want to try to get some calls in the next half hour. I'm Art Bell from the High Desert. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001.
There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong.
Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 18th, 2001.
I love that line because I believe it. A wise man has the power. I believe that. A wise man does have the power. We're going to take a few calls for Richard C. Hoagland and finish up this 30-minute segment coming up immediately. Don't move a muscle.
We take you back to the night of October 18th, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Well, all right, Richard, we've covered a lot of territory. If you have anything you want to get out before I start punching lines here in this last segment, get it out now.
Well, let's see, I think we've kind of covered the waterfront.
Good. All right, good, good. We're going to lines right now, then. And let's see what people have to say about all of this. On the wildcard line, you're on the air with Richard C. Hoagland and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi there.
Name is Kat, KSFO Country, near San Francisco.
Okay.
One of my favorite places.
The City Beneath the Sea. There's an explanation that everybody seems to be forgetting, and you've got a good example of that near you, Art. It's called Lake Tahoe.
Yes.
The explanation is block faulting, where blocks either suddenly rise or fall, and there is no limit on the size of the block.
Yeah, this is pretty much what Ron and I had discussed, Art, back when the story broke. That what you do is you have a global event, or even a local event, you know, major geological event.
Right.
And you have a large block with the city on top of it basically fall half a mile. And the gentleman is absolutely right. That is the one rational explanation. Now, the thing is, it's got to be one humongous geological event for that to happen. And it's got to be just the right geology so you don't wind up with pulverized city as opposed to something pretty intact.
Well, so he's saying you're right, sir.
Well, that is something that long time ago I picked up in Geology 101.
Now, so, the key is, of course, what's the dating? The guys I'm talking to who are plugged in say they're thinking 50,000. Well, I'm going to bet it's going to come out closer to 13,000, which is a whole other show.
Yeah, it sure is.
Well, as far as the dating, that's kind of irrelevant because you can have that happen due to either the hit of some large object on the Earth or the close passage of a very large object.
Yeah, okay, but it's not irrelevant. It's going to tell us many things. It is an item of great scientific curiosity. The actual date is absolutely fascinating. I wouldn't say it's at all irrelevant.
And the one thing I guess I forgot to tell everybody is that my sources are saying that we're not dealing with Mayan kind of architecture. We're dealing with something more sophisticated art. Yeah.
Well, how can you not think, at least think about Atlantis when you talk about this, Richard? How can you not?
You can't. And that's why I went back to the Templar business, because when we got onto that, as I was saying, if they picked up ancient traditional documentation preserved as sacred knowledge from a long time ago,
right,
when we had not lost the science due to a global catastrophe, the
right,
standard model,
right,
then a secret group or groups hang on to this because knowledge is power. And remember, we're dealing, as we've discussed tonight, with something bigger than the A-bomb. It stands to reason that if we're not the first, if history is cyclic, if the planet goes through episodes, if civilization and consciousness have risen and fallen, then, you know, it explains everything going all the way back to what we see on Mars. It's this idea, the Victorian idea, that we're the first on the runway, we've never done this or gone this way before, that is at fault. And that's why this has such enormous potential. You know, that and the Mars story have the potential to turn this into an extraordinary year's ending on an extraordinarily uplifting note.
Oh, you know, Richard, I expect an extraordinary end of this year. I don't doubt
it. I do, too.
I don't doubt it for one second. We're really in the middle of, and I haven't said it in months and months and months, but if this is not the quickening, then there is no such thing. And there is, and we're in it. And we've been in it for a while now, but the pace, folks, it's picking up. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Richard C. Hoagland. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, where are you?
I am actually in Wilmington, North Carolina, and actually I wanted to say hi to Richard. I am from Albuquerque, New Mexico, so I'm homesick right now.
Aww.
I'm really glad to speak with you. I was hoping this is the one night I can get through to you. I'm actually, I guess you can call me a student of esoteric and mystery school studies. And the reason why I wanted to speak with you, I noticed that on New Year's Day, or on 9/11, it was a Coptic New Year. I noticed that you mentioned something about that on your website.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you how you think that correlates with what happened that day and what we can do as a collective consciousness to possibly look further into this incident on our own.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that we need to also come together as a group and focus together, but I think it's also our responsibility to go out and get this information outside of what the media is telling us.
The thing we cannot allow to happen, because that's what they wanted, was to live in fear. Fear is the great enemy here. It's not Bin Laden. It's not these little envelopes running around. It's fear. Fear.
Sure it is.
And I was so proud of Dan, you know, who stood there, you know, with his own assistant, you know, basically attacked. And he looked beyond the horizon. He said, this is not about this problem. It's about fear and the American psyche. And if we let fear overtake us, as everyone has been saying, they win. And they want to win by driving the fear in these windows and manipulating us like we've been doing with this experiment set tonight.
Kind of like psychic vampires.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And the antidote is to turn the tables on them, to understand this physics, to reconnect with it, to understand its power, how to use it, and to put positive things in place of negative things. Now, to some people, that's going to sound like airy-fairy, you know, New Age mumbo-jumbo.
Right.
Well, we've got data from around the world in those Princeton graphs to prove it's not.
You know, actually, somebody mentioned to me in the past year for months that there is going to be an upcoming struggle. It's going to be between good and evil. And I just kind of noticed that now that everything's happening, it's amazing the hell out of me. And I'm also concerned with some other issues. If I can get your opinion, maybe what you think about what's going on in the East, possibly with China in our relationships with them, because I noticed we've been a little rocky with them, and the media isn't exactly telling us everything.
Well, don't you find it interesting that in the middle of this crisis, with the House abandoning Capitol Hill, which I thought was a disgraceful precedent, the president gets on Air Force One, and tonight is in China,
right,
of all places.
Yes, he is.
And that is not an accident. That is a part of a larger global plan to get ahead of this curve. I'm telling you, this is going to be one hell of a year before it's over, Art.
Well, it's already, if it did nothing else, it's made it already. All right, thank you very much, young lady.
And thank you guys very much. I love you guys. Good night.
Good night. Yeah, it's already made it as a year. I mean, this one will be forever in the history books and ever and ever and ever.
See, the interesting thing is, if you carefully read our piece, and when I come back, I will have, you know, worked with the guys at Princeton and Dean and others, we will have some real numbers to put in place of some of the modeling we've been doing.
Well, if you have information for me as early as next week,
yes,
Richard, I want it right away.
We'll sit on it. Don't worry.
Good. All right. West of the Rockies, you are on the air with Richard C. Hoagland and Art Bell. Hello.
Good evening, gentlemen. Gary, I'm on Como out of Seattle.
Okay. Where are my
other favorite places.
Where are you? You're in Seattle, of course.
In Seattle,
question. I'm sorry, what's your first name?
Gary.
Gary, okay, Gary.
I'm glad I could get through, because this kind of goes along with what Richard was talking about, proceeding beyond and having, turning the tide. It seems to me that what this nation needs right now is great ideas to get us beyond its fear. And, two of the things he was talking about, possibly finding life on Mars and maybe finding something about this undersea city, I think we're in a receptive mood now, psychically, to kind of crack ourselves open. But let me put another slight idea forward here. What if, even though I think our government's a little bit in the grip of the oil lobby, just as the Saudis are in the grip of their fundamentalists, but what if our president would announce like a crash program to immediately, within 5 years, something like the Manhattan Project, convert our economy to hydrogen and free ourselves from the grip of this Middle East oil politics? Think how that would defang our enemies. We could denounce we were going to be withdrawing our troops from Saudi Arabia pretty soon, and we wouldn't even have to do it under war-kind conditions like they did with the Manhattan Project.
You won't find any disagreement for me.
I mean, wouldn't this be a great idea for our country to undertake right now?
Well, there's a whole series of cutting-edge technologies that are kind of sitting on some black ops shelf. Art, there was a website I wanted to send you, and I didn't have time. It was sent to me, and I went prowling around. There's a little company in Huntsville, Alabama, which is comprised of some ex-NASA employees, and they basically have a real media or Windows media video on their website showing a zero electrogravitic experiment where they energize a set of capacitors in a certain geometry configuration, and this thing leaps off the table and hovers about 12 inches above the platform until they turn the power off. And I'm going to send that to you tomorrow. I'll email it to you, and you can have Keith stick it on the site. It is the damnedest thing you've ever seen, and the company is, transparent. We know who they are. This is real stuff, not fake. This is hyperdimensional technology in action, and it's T. Townsend Brown electrogravitics. And it suddenly is all over the web. It's like, where were these guys? They've been doing it since June, and they've now got version 4 that they put up on this site, and it is the most amazing thing because, again, it violates certain current ideas of the laws of physics, but in fact, it's a very ancient technology.
Well, there's a whole world waiting to open, Richard. It's
there
been there the whole time, and we just haven't known how to open the door. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Richard C. Hoagland and Art Bell. Hi.
Yeah, would that be me?
That would be you. Where are you, sir?
I'm calling from Asheville, North Carolina.
Okay.
I've listened to your show off and on and never really been super inspired to call until you started talking about all this global cosmic consciousness and the experiments you've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could, I have some really important event that I'd like to talk to you both about, but I have a quick question just about the phone calling, just because I've never called before, and just help me in the future if I want to call. Do you only take calls when you say you're about to take calls, or?
Yes, either I'm in open lines, I'll be in open lines tomorrow night, and then we'll take calls all night, or if I have a guest, I open the lines at I don't know, whenever it seems appropriate to do it.
Like you just said, I'm going to take calls the next 30 minutes, so calling before that is kind of in vain.
Useless, yes, useless.
Okay, that's what I need to know, because I'm calling on 3 times. But anyway, kind of what I wanted to inform you about, and then I have a question or request for...
All right, we got to do it quickly, sir, so go ahead.
Okay, yeah, quickly, are you familiar with an event called Earth Dance?
Earth what?
Earth Dance.
Earth Dance?
Yes.
Not specifically, no.
No.
Okay. It's the event that we just did on October 13th, and it's coordinated by someone out in San Francisco called Chris Dicker.
In order to accomplish what?
Well, it's a global dance party for world peace, but the apex or the peak of the event is a link-up time around the planet. This year, there was over 120 cities around the globe that were participating. The link-up time was at 7 o'clock p.m. on Eastern Time, midnight in London.
All right.
And at that time...
Coordinated.
It totally synchronized. At that time, all of the DJs that are involved with it play a track, which is a prayer for world peace. And that occurred this Saturday on October 13th. And, of course, they have it synced up on the... there's actually a website that I encourage you to look at. It's earthdance.org.
I don't suppose I should rudely point out to you that we've been bombing the hell out of Afghanistan since that day.
Roughly. Right. but the reason I'm bringing this up is it completely ties in with what you're doing with your little experiment there. And he's been doing it since 1997.
Oh, it absolutely does. And I don't, for one second, diminish what you've said with regard to world peace. I'm sure that if everything we're saying is really true tonight, then a goal of that magnitude would be doable. It would be doable. If what we're saying is true tonight, then probably, ultimately, something like that would be doable.
Well, see, here is my prediction. These global events, unless they are coordinated with the hyperdimensional windows, will not work. And we have a way of testing that prediction. What we're going to have is the guys at Princeton, Dean Radin and others, are going to look at the data from tonight. You know, the random number generators.
Yes.
We will know within a day or so, and obviously you'll know as soon as I know, what happens, and next week we'll come on and we'll lay out the results. We'll probably even have some neat graphs.
Well, just in case we're not at a hyper-dimensionally
we'll reschedule
exactly.
For when we calculate that the force is with us.
Exactly.
And we'll match that.
Exactly.
This is an ongoing experiment with 20 million of our nearest friends to participate.
Although I must say, Richard, unless I picked... And there were too many experiments I've run previously to imagine that I picked them all at, you know, just the appropriate time.
Yep.
And yet they worked anyway, so...
Well, remember, the model is that it's more efficient if you do it in a window.
Right, I understand.
So we're going to see what the... In other words, we got numbers now to work with.
And we have the ability to experiment. Yes,
exactly.
Indeed. All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Richard C. Hoagland. Hello.
Yeah. I thought about the... Brookings report since the incident happened on September 11th.
That's a good observation, sir.
I was wondering if a religious fundamentalism that can't deal with just the ordinary, everyday, modern advances of knowledge, maybe the Brookings group was onto something. And
listen. I couldn't be more with you. Richard, this guy's right on the money. Brookings, we all know what the Brookings report said.
Yeah, Brookings is an official report 30 years ago that said if we all found out that things were not quite the way we've been told in history, we'd all freak out and there'd be cats and dogs living together and all other terrible things.
Yeah, all right. Well, to some degree, Richard, you've got to admit, if you're looking at this completely objectively, although there have been many calls, there's been much bravery and many calls for calm and to keep all of this in perspective and so forth and so on. Nevertheless, the media has gone totally berserk. It has affected the psyche of the average American person. There is no argument with all of that. I mean, it's simply true.
So, 7,000 people die in real time. It does something to you.
Well, I'm not just talking about the events of the 11th, but even the subsequent anthrax baloney.
Without the events of the 11th and the bending of reality in that window, the anthrax thing would be nothing. It would be dealt with on the scale of the Unabomber.
Well,
Remember, we've
I
only
wonder.
Had half
I
a dozen
wonder.
Envelopes, and only one person has died, and even he
yeah.
didn't have to die if he'd gotten himself
I
to
know.
A doctor in time. I mean, what we're looking at here is a
no.
Is
I'm
a
with you there, but yes, but nevertheless, Richard,
in the wake of September 11th, it was totally different than if it had happened by itself. So the two I see as synchronized, and I see this as a psycho-terror plan designed to instill fear and leverage fear, and the antidote has got to be we don't play that game.
But objectively, Richard, looking at what it has done, to some degree it has succeeded. People are scared.
In the short term.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
why I want them
so,
to call and write Tommy Thompson
so it,
and get on the nanobomb stuff
but
the other thing.
I understand, but his comment about Brookings is worth academic consideration.
Well, when you say Brookings, how in fact are you meaning it? Do you mean
well, I'm meaning that there can be something that can come along that can be too damn big, that it will cause too much trouble socially, a disproportionate amount of trouble socially, and maybe there are some things that it's better that we don't know. Put bluntly.
Well, but watching fellow human beings die horribly on live television...
That was unavoidable.
...is not the same as learning that we're not alone academically...
Anyway, listen, Richard.
...millions of miles away.
This is another program.
Another show.
Yes, and
gosh,
there will be...
Where will we be if we didn't have another show, Art?
I don't know. This one's over, though. As always, even more than always, it has been a pleasure to have you here tonight. This one will go down... I trust we'll go down in history, Richard.
I think we've done something interesting, and I can't wait to see the results, guys.
Me too. Have a good night, Richard.
You too, everyone.
Till next time, my friend. Good night. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Ta-ta. I'll be having lunch with Crystal here at the house. Woo!
You think that people... I'd like to know, 'cause he